Welcome, everyone. I'd like to open the meeting for the Joint Committee on Legislative Office, Audits. That's a good start. Audits, Information Management, and Technology. Thank you so much for being here. So we have a very full day today, so we're going to go ahead and get started. We're going to have a series of three audits that we will hear about from Gary Blackmer with the Secretary of State's office. And then we're going to review some of our major IT projects, including the core systems replacement for the Department of Revenue, the eCourt update, and state radio project. And then we're going to finish up the day with an update on Cover Oregon. So let's go ahead and get started with the audits. What we're going to do today is we're going to have Gary Blackmer come up and give the audits, and then we're going to have response from some of the folks on the topics of the audits. And I think that is a it's a new thing, but I think it's a really good way to go for this committee to have a really full discussion, and so that this committee has a chance to both hear the audit and the response for the audit, so that we get a good update on the subject matter. So with that, I'd like to call Gary Blackmer to come up and give the first audit. And at that time, should we go ahead and call it? Okay.
Let's let him go first.
Okay.
And I'll introduce her.
Also. Okay, perfect.
We'll sit down when we're done.
Okay. So welcome.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Vega Peterson. Thank you very much for inviting us here. We have a variety of audits in front of you that we want to talk about. And I guess I want to start just very briefly to talk about how we choose these topics, because I think it's one of the most important decisions that we make. And obviously there are times when the legislature asks us to do an audit, and we accommodate those. And there are other times when we feel like it's an area where we can find an improvement in an organization, or we believe that there's an opportunity there. And the area of opportunity that we see is in the management of the resources, trying to get the greatest value for the dollars. And that is not necessarily policy. It's really, we take what the legislature puts into law, and we determine how well that's being accomplished, and are there better ways of achieving it? Are there ways that we can realign our resources, or through better training or guidance, be able to achieve more? So that's kind of what we're looking for. And oftentimes one audit leads to another audit, leads to another audit, in the sense that we start an audit by kind of scanning across the territory to see what actually is going on in various topic areas, and if we see one that we think is exactly right for an audit, we'll take that on. Occasionally, we might run across several of them, and we'll put those onto a list and pick it up later on and think about it, is the timing right for doing this audit? So we are learning as we go forward about organizations and getting into depth with them, but we're also inviting agencies. If what I see oftentimes in the state is agencies might have 1,000 or 7,000 employees, and it's difficult sometimes to provide assurance that what is intended to be accomplished actually is happening on the front lines. And our auditors spend a lot of time out talking to employees, observing how services are provided. You'll see some examples of that in these audits here, where we really try to reach out and understand exactly how services are provided, because if we can make an improvement on the front lines of an agency, that has an immediate benefit for the public who's receiving those services, and it also helps the agency better achieve the mission that's intended by the legislature. So we look at ourselves as kind of management reviewers, and we're able to see problems and then diagnose what the causes are and then make recommendations. And we really focus on what the mission of the agency is, which again goes back to the front lines of what is the agency really trying to accomplish with its services. And if we can help it better achieve its mission, then that is exactly what the legislature hopes for. So we bring the reports back to you and show you how well they are achieving it and how they could do better. And we also do follow-up at the end, and we occasionally go in and actually issue reports on follow-up, but we do annually check in with the agencies and see what they're doing and look at the compliance with our recommendations. So that gives you a quick overview of how we are constantly engaged with the agencies on selection. So with that, let me start with an audit we conducted of temporary assistance for needy families. And let's see, I guess I'm going to have to get over here. I thought the mouse would do it, but
it will.
It will? Huh? Left mouse, right mouse. No? All right, I will do the down page on this. All right, I'm going to cover this in a little bit, but let me start with painting a picture of Oregon. This audit really was, oh, I forgot to introduce my compatriot. With me is the audit manager in charge of this audit, Sandra Hilton. She's here to help me with hard questions, and if you guys come up with some real difficult ones, we have Jamie Rawls, who is the principal in charge of this audit, who can give you details beyond anything we could ever give, and maybe more than you want to hear. But in any case, What we looked at and what we saw was that Oregon was going into the Great Recession and had huge challenges. And this gives you a picture of the unemployment rate by county in 2007. And the blue color is 4 to 6% unemployment. And it looks like there's quite a bit of blue in Oregon. Here's 2008. The yellow is 8 to 10% unemployment. Here's 2009. The red is 14 to 18% unemployment. Here's 2010, not much different. But what you can see is a majority of Oregon was 8% or more. In fact, 10% or more, the yellow, the orange, and the red. So there was a deep impact on Oregon in terms of jobs and unemployment. Here's 2011, things were getting a little bit better. 2012, still improving, though there still was one county that was struggling in terms of unemployment. Here's what we kind of, let me jump into what I was going to talk about next, which is that we have, let me find my paperwork here. What the Department of Human Services was struggling with was how to address this in the beginning of the recession, and it brought in the legislature and the governor in terms of decisions on how to address a huge increase in its workload when there were many needy families that were losing their breadwinner and losing their income and approaching TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, for cash payments to help them through the recession. So after it hit, Oregon collectively, like other states, had to decide how to respond to the growing demand for the assistance from these kinds of programs. Now, TANF contributions from the federal government are fixed, so beyond that required state general funds. And so the state had to decide, do we want to limit access to the TANF program, or do we want to help as many families as we can? And the general approach was, let's see how we can stretch our dollars to reach as many families as we can. So what happened was, essentially, Oregon had one of the largest increases in the number of TANF recipients in the country. You can see that it was in the bracket of 60 to 89% increase in TANF recipients. The way that it did it was by cutting back on other expenses and instead focusing on benefits to the families. So essentially a cut back on services and, let me jump back. Here's what Oregon looked like in terms of a change from the service districts of DHS from 2007 to 2013. And what you see is the lighter colors are a 50% to 90% increase in TANF cases, And the dark brown, the darkest, is 170 to 250% increase in TANF clients. So there was essentially a very, very large increase in Eastern Oregon in the number of TANF recipients during that period. And what this is a graph that shows the TANF families from 2007 all the way through, and the dotted lines are projections that DHS prepared through 2017. So what you see is the light blue line on the bottom. They went from 926 families in 2007 to 5,764 in 2013. The dark blue line, that was a single-parent family. The dark blue line, the two-parent family, went from 17,400 in 2007 to 29,535. And the projections, as you can see, start going down, but they don't get to the point where we were prior to the recession. So by cutting back on the services that it provided to families, it was able to provide more cash benefits. What that meant was these are two sets of bar charts that show the services on the left, and 2007 to 2009, the far left, we spent about $240 per family on services. Over the period of time to 2011-13, that dropped to $68 in services for families. And those services were intended to help families through issues that would help them be more employable, through assistance with education, with child care, with other kinds of mental health and other dependencies so that they could rejoin the workforce. Similarly, the expenditures on staff per family dropped from $102 per family to $58. So what that meant was there were many cases where the caseload of the caseworkers doubled up to, and some case managers had up to 200 families that they were trying to serve. And that was all intended to put as much money into assisting these folks. And from the standpoint of a very high unemployment rate, the idea about trying to help these family members get a job and spending money when there wasn't a job seemed to be, at least from what we read in our research, part of the intent of the legislature and the department, that it was the hope that this would help tide them over until jobs came back. And so we saw a big drop in the amount of money spent on services as well as staff. So we did see, when we went in and looked at how those services were provided, and we did see a lot of progress, but we did see, because of the lack of services and the lack of staff time, that there were a lot of clients who were not getting the attention that was needed in order to help them get work. And that's understandable given when there were no jobs. But from this point out, we our view was the timing was really good for this audit, because as the economy's coming back, this is a time when we need to start thinking about how we're going to help these families get back to be self-sustaining and help them get the well-paying jobs that they can then get off of TANF. So in looking at some of the case files, what we saw was that there were case records where there were clients that were really not getting contact from case managers for months, sometimes years, that the case plans themselves were rushed and very few words or not at all, and those plans were intended to help the client get work, and so it was really difficult for caseworkers to kind of work with the client to build those. We saw gaps of months, sometimes a year or more, when there was no contact between the client and the case managers. And we picked 1 month, June 2013, and we found in our sample that 2/3 of the clients had no recorded activity in that month. So this kind of gives you an idea about the outcome of Oregon relative to other states. This is in 2010. The average hours of reported activity per eligible client, meaning what the client was doing in terms of efforts. And Oregon was one of the states in the 14 hour to 18 hour reported range, as opposed to others like Colorado. I believe, yeah, Colorado there was 31% to 35%. So we saw that the clients were not getting the attention that they needed from a very thin and available set of caseworkers. So the recommendations we made to DHS were to work with the legislature and governor to consider revisiting those budget and program decisions made during the recession, using the data that's out there to assess program performance and client needs and match up the needs for the various services that have been cut to what the clients currently need. Track progress, build time limits into case planning, and conduct intensive case reviews at key intervals with clients, such as at 24 and 48 months. Increase discussions of client progress during recertifications and routine client contacts, meaning are they still eligible for TANF? Are there ways that they can be moved on? Oops. There was several other key recommendations that we saw that there's something called the welfare cliff, which is the fact that at a certain earnings level, the client loses a lot of benefits, such as childcare especially, and it makes it even more difficult for them to make that leap into self-sufficiency when they reach a certain point of income and suddenly they fall backward and they have less money that they can spend on their household. So there are a number of recommendations like that we felt like should be revisited and addressed. So this, I think, gives you at least a quick overview of this audit. And is there anything I can add, you can add at this point?
No, I think you did a good job covering that.
Okay. So I'd be happy to answer questions you may have. I know that we have two representatives from DHS that will sit down and let them talk. And if there's any other discussion, I'm happy to rejoin the group.
Madam Chair, would you prefer that we actually wait for the other people to testify before I ask questions? Or do you want me to ask questions of this panel or just to enter into discussion with this panel?
So why don't we go ahead and if you have questions specific to the audit report, and then and we can go ahead with those, and then we can have folks come up, and then we'll see if there may be some answers that are best answered by then. So go ahead and ask the questions.
Okay. Part of it is actually a discussion. So you framed the audit relatively well. There are some areas that I'll probably make some statements later about that were not included in the audit in terms of, I think sometimes when audits are presented and I'm looking at your actual audit report and sort of the narrative of it, where it talks as if we were making a disinvestment in one area, and you did point out that we were making more investments in other areas, but I don't think there's enough context in this to understand what the level of those investments were. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make my statement as part of the question, and you interact with this, and then I have the impression here is that the state did not make a significant investment in this biennium in self-sufficiency programs. However, the state's general fund contribution to self-sufficiency programs increased roughly 20% in this biennium. It just so happens that it did not increase that much in terms of the jobs-related program. I mean, I'm just trying to find sometimes that audits need to be put in a more broad context. I mean, let me give you another example. I'm cheating on you. You know that. The state's total human services expenditures in 2007-09, all funds budget, was $11+ billion. If I was unfair, I would tell you that the state's total expenditures in all funds budget in human services now is $25 billion. It's actually more like about 22, because your PEB and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board were rolled into OHA, and they're not really human services expenditures, and they account for about 3. But I think the casual observer somehow believes that we've divested in human services programs, when the reality is probably almost the opposite when you look at the growth in that area in the budget. And one question I would ask, so I can get back to your limitation, You mentioned other states that actually obviously had higher contact numbers, did not have the same growth numbers. Did you do any research on, they obviously had the same, in many cases, the same unemployment issues we had. Actually, some states were actually hit harder than Oregon, although we were close to the top of the pack. They must have actually limited or reduced their eligibility criteria to do that. Would that be a correct statement?
Chair Vega Peterson, co-chair co-chair of Dublin, yes, that would be a correct statement.
Okay. So and that actually kind of really identifies the choice that was available to mm-hmm. the legislature.
And to the degree that we were looking at the delivery of services and what could be done with the available money, from the standpoint of the fact that it was limited and difficult to make those hard decisions. Do we invest in services or do we try to help as many families as possible? Was one of those difficult choices I think Oregon faced in the beginning or in the middle of the recession. So we didn't want to discount that at all, and we actually tried to portray that bigger picture. Obviously, that steps into the policy area of what the legislature struggles with, and we try not to second-guess what the decision should have been. We at least try to say, these are the consequences of where we are, given the decisions that have been made, without judgment to whether they're the right decisions or the wrong decisions. So I hope I answered that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Wilson.
Thank you. On OLIS, I'm looking at the documents you submitted, and it said you have in bold letters, holding clients accountable is cumbersome and time-consuming. Have we done anything to improve that?
Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson, the Department of Human Services has redirected, I believe, about 147 of its intake personnel to work, or the positions to be case managers. And that is a key to holding clients accountable, is being able to meet with them regularly. And when we estimated that a typical case manager could only spend about 45 minutes a month on each case in their portfolio, it's really difficult to hold those folks accountable. So to the degree that we think actions are being taken to address accountability, and we point out in our recommendations, those are key elements of helping clients become self-sufficient. We think at least that's a step in the right direction.
Thank you.
And Senator Olson, I think that's a good segue to invite the folks that we have from DHS here today. So I'll invite Liesl Wendt, Jill Gray, and I know we have John Mullins from the Oregon Law Center also up here. But Gary, don't go too far away.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Liesl Wendt, Self-Sufficiency Director for the Department of Human Services. And thank you, co-chairs, for having us here today and part of your new format to talk about or have the agency respond to the audit. I wanted to just start, we've got a brief, just a couple slide deck to give you some, a little bit further context to get a little bit to your question, Senator Devlin, around what was the situation at the time that the audit took place. And then mostly I want to focus my comments on where we're headed. The audit findings came at a time where we're obviously looking at the economy improving, needing to make some different policy investments and or changes in the program. So I want to really steer our direction there. And just for grounding, I think it's important to remember that this is a program, but it's really a program for people. It's a program designed for families, parents, and kids. And the next slide, Jill Gray, our legislative coordinator, is our assistant today. Thank you. This is just a typical profile to give you a sense of who's on the program. Primarily single moms with kids, although we have seen an increase in two-parent families when the economy turned. And families actually are only getting $506 a month. I'll use the single mom with two kids through the presentation because it's just easier than lots of different family makeups. And to be eligible for the program, that's $616 per month. That's 38% of the federal poverty level. So you have to be incredibly poor to even be eligible for the program, which I think, again, just puts it in context that we're talking about the very poor in our community and the investments that the legislature made on the safety net for those folks. So we'll move on to the next piece. The auditing team talked about the challenge with caseload versus case managers, but I think this sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words, right? So I think this picture really illustrates just how challenging the situation has been in our field offices and what that dramatic increase of growth was really hitting in 2008. So I think part of the good news story is our team in the field did a tremendous job under really challenging circumstances since 2008, adapting processes, becoming leaner and more efficient to really serve people with their basic needs. Now, did it come with a cost in terms of other outcomes? Certainly, but I just want to put that in context. I think tremendous work. I think of those case managers with 200 families on their caseload with little to connect them to. That's a tough job. So as we look ahead, one of the things that we had actually already had in place when the audit came out is a stakeholder group representing workforce, housing, local counties, different folks looking at the issue of not just TANF, but poverty reduction. And we asked that group to come together and say, if we were to make different investments in the program, would we go back and buy back the services that were cut from 2007? Or because the state has changed so much in terms of other policy designs, early learning hubs, CCOs, workforce redesign, would it make more sense to look at what role does a TANF program play in light of those other system changes? So kind of change the frame a little bit to see if that would change the outcome. And really, what's interesting is the recommendations do fit under a lot of the key categories from the audit findings. If we look at case management, hard to hold people accountable when you're barely checking in with people and you're really processing more than you're doing that people work. And I think the other piece I just really want to emphasize on case management is it's the relationship. I think all of us experience that, whether it's going to a doctor you don't know versus your primary care doctor. It's a different relationship. So how do we invest in that person-centered, strength-based approach to the work? And partnerships was a key piece that was identified in the audit, really focused on CCO collaboration. But as I mentioned, early learning hubs are a key area in local communities looking at supporting families with young children. What does our relationship need to look like with early learning hubs? I come primarily from a nonprofit background, and nonprofits also struggled since the recession. Very thin safety net, but also how do we leverage what does exist in local communities and do it in a way that's tailored to communities? Burns is different than Northeast Portland, than is different in Klamath. We have a one-size-fits-all program. How do we look at creating flexibility in the program so it's more tailored for local needs? We actually probably did a small happy dance in talking about data. We know we don't have adequate data. We know our systems are not both user-friendly for our case managers and certainly also aren't user-friendly for data mining. When we look at what are the biggest needs of our TANF families, we literally go through and read case notes and have to have somebody look at a cohort and try to make some sense out of what are the challenges for that family. That's not really where we want to be. So in looking forward, we've looked at what if we partnered with higher ed to do either a TANF leaver study or somehow do a much more in-depth look at when people do leave the program, why? Is it for a job? Are they successful 90 days, a year out? But making sure that families really are self-sufficient. So some investment there. The auditors talked about the fiscal cliff. One of the challenges for the TANF program is that if we go back to the single mom with two kids, if you make $617 a month, you're off the program. So as we've looked at some potential reinvestments, look at taking that exit out to $1,100 a month. So your benefit would go down, as your income goes up. And, you know, honestly, also rewarding work. We're saying that we want people to go to work, and yet we have somewhat of a disincentive built into the program to actually support that. Some of the other states that have had better federal participation rates, that's one of the ways that they've been able to do that. They're counting those activities as opposed to Oregon, where we're cutting those families off the program. Client engagement was a significant factor in the audit. It's a significant factor for us in the field. When we looked at other states and what they've done around the TANF program, actually states and jurisdictions, Washington, D.C. just went through a TANF redesign. And when they did the program, they really looked at their client sanction policy. And what about that policy was not supportive for people that were on the program, time intensive for the workers. It certainly is an issue that surfaced in this audit. So as we look at client re-engagement, one of the big issues is, are we actually explaining to folks really well, here's the expectation for you, here's the expectation for us, and this is how we're going to work together so that you're successful, so that we're successful. So some investment both in our approach, which will require some policy changes and some minor investments in that engagement side of the equation. We'll move on. I think the most important piece, and I'm not sure this really came out in the audit, is the program's really designed to stabilize families and move them to employment. What we know about low-income families, especially when we look at the threshold for the TANF program, there's a lot of issues going on for folks, and it's not a simple linear path to move out of poverty. And as we look at this redesign, we've looked at, as I mentioned earlier, the local flexibility, but also that recognition that families might, you know, move three steps forward, have a challenge, and instead of there being a negative consequence to that challenge, how do we support them in that moment, problem solve, get them connected to the right resources, and then help them move on to the next step along the way, but recognizing it's not necessarily a linear process. And this sort of echoes that, I think, as we've also talked about the program, we want people to get a job that pays so that they're not necessarily coming back onto the program. A fair number of families come back onto the program, and we don't really have a retention focus. So we've looked at redesign. We've looked at it would be a far better investment to invest in checking in with families at 60 days when they're on a new job, 120 days, making sure they've got backup childcare, transportation, those pieces so that they're not coming back onto the program. I think it's a bit analogous to the healthcare conversation with ER visits versus sort of that prevention care. And I think it's bringing that model to this program as we look at future investments. And importantly, everything around the redesign has really been driven by what are the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. And they really range from some of those family stability pieces to income, getting a job, keeping a job, getting a job that hopefully moves them up on the income scale and hopefully with better benefits. So that pathways to employment is a significant piece of what we're looking towards in the redesign. Right now, we already have some good, I think, baby steps in that effort. We have a strong collaboration with our workforce partners on the NCRC testing, for example, sector strategies, really trying to link people to the jobs in their communities. So where we're at just in terms of the redesign process, as I mentioned, we had a stakeholder group this summer. We've been working closely with the governor's office on a policy option package for next session. We're in the throes of details and putting details under all of those different recommendations, and we'll be doing that through the fall and then hopefully bringing some recommendations forward next session. So thank you. If there's any questions, or I'll turn it over to John Mullen.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. We work on behalf of low-income people and work towards access to justice for low-income people, and so we have been involved in this discussion for a long, long time. I'm also here on behalf of the TANF Alliance. I just want to just give a couple of quick historical references. When the program was changed at the federal level back in 1996, where welfare was changed was converted basically to a block grant, temporary assistance for needy families. We basically had a program that went on for a number of years that didn't have stated goals and purposes. In 2007, then freshman Representative Kotek and Representative Maurer, a bipartisan approach to looking at the program, said we need to really make this how I termed it, Oregon's program. And we took a look at really what the issues were, the presenting issues that relate to how people can become self-sufficient. And we looked at it kind of like as a continuum. The pre-TANF program was established, so if somebody could get some assistance and not get on TANF and get their need taken care of, that was great. Then we looked at the TANF program as a whole and said, well, there are a number of components. We had the jobs component because there was one in place then. But we also said we need to really identify and assess people properly so that people that have long-term disabling conditions, we're not going to spend resources on helping them to get in the job market, but helping them to get federal disability benefits as part of their self-sufficiency. We also invested a very small amount of money in parents as scholars to say the people that really had an opportunity, limited to 1% of the caseload, to get education, and that would be their pathway out. But in the main, we also then thought about how we can invest in the jobs program and helping the people to get into the workforce. And then finally, we had a post-TANF component to say we really want to make sure that people are able to stay off the program, and we had some cash assistance to phase out. Now, when we did that and we had beginning to have remarkable success, and we all know what happened in 2008, the economy just went in the tank, and there were a lot of changes that had to be made to a number of state programs. So as we roll this forward and we think about this and where we are now, I happened to be on the governor's transition team when we took a look at the budget, and we made those decisions about the governor's budget about doing just exactly what the Secretary of State's audit said. We decided we would invest in benefits rather than trying to provide a lot of services in the jobs program when there were not jobs there. But the whole idea was that when the economy had an uptick, we wanted to go back and reinvest in the jobs program. And so advocates, when the Secretary of State's audit came out, said, you know, there really are a lot of things in the audit that we agree with, and we in fact came out with a statement about that. And we recognized that one of the things that happened in the program back before welfare reform, as it was called, the last real increase in the grant amount happened in 1991. If you could imagine somebody in a job not having an increase since 1991. But what that did is that even as people moved off and move on the program, it meant eligibility, you had to be more and more, you had to have less and less resources to even qualify to get on the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program. And then at the other end, if you were making even a very small amount of money, as Liesl pointed out, you would wind off off the program. And so we think that the whole idea of taking another look now at the TANF program, because as Liesl mentioned, conditions have really changed in the economy. We have new arrangements such as early learning and the coordinated care organizations. This is the perfect time to look at redesign. And it comes from, you know, a classic sort of look at resources. What does it take to get the job done? So that really means case management positions, but it also means renewing and reinvesting in partnerships. And it means a number of things that take a fresh approach about how we will do this particular kind of work. And I just want to say that the whole discussion about redesign has been really reinvigorating to the advocacy community, and we are very pleased with our state partners engaging with us every step of the way about talking about, if we had the means to make this work, how would it work? And one of the things that I think we're all committed to, and this may come as a surprise to some people when you hear advocates say this, we're not interested in a large caseload. We're interested in making sure that people are protected when they have problems and issues, but that we also have people successfully move off the program. And so we're very willing and very much committed to working further with the department, and we are hoping that the governor will take up this issue and we'll see some of these reinvestment ideas being talked about in the governor's recommended budget. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Question?
Question for Ms. Wendt. This is a difficult question, and I may be putting you in a difficult position, but probably it's good to start now. In our best of all possibilities of hope, we have probably a 10% usable growth in general fund, lottery fund revenue in the next biennium. For all of human services, if you are going to be proportionally increased compared to other major functions of state government, that would equal about $440 million. Have there been discussions in terms of, because if it's larger than that, then you actually have to take from other areas in the budget. And the reality is going to be, is in most areas, we are going to have difficulty meeting requirements given the dollars that have been entrusted to us. So you've got two choices. One, how you use the $440+ million, if that's the decision of the legislature, or how you reallocate the roughly $4.4 billion that you have in the budget in terms of general funds.
Co-Chair Devlin, thank you for the question.
Has that discussion been part of this?
It has.
In
it
the
has.
Sense, and a sense of reality about mm-hmm. what the actual resources of the state are.
Yes, that's a great question. Yes, so the conversation we've had with the governor's office is a modest investment. If we looked at projected caseload, you saw a little bit on the slide that the auditor's office presented. If you looked at the caseload going down, what those savings would be relative to the last forecast, it would be roughly 30 million. So what could we do with 30 million that would be budget improvements? But many of the recommendations that we've looked at, some of those are policy improvements. So some don't necessarily require dollars, require kind of that trade-off that you're suggesting at looking at, we've done it this way, what if we start to do work this way? So it's a small investment. And when we looked at staffing, we really looked at what if we staffed to the families who are hitting the federal time limit, which would actually be roughly 3,000 families the last month of next biennium, making sure that as a state, we're not leaving those particular families vulnerable. So that's sort of how we looked at, if we were to target a small investment of staff, how would we figure out that what that number would be? Is that helpful?
Yes. Follow-up. This is not my statement, but I'm just repeating statements that I've heard in Ways and Means. Sometimes jobs programs are characterized as how many times do you train a person to write a resume that has no significant job experience? Or how many times do you train them to do an interview when chances of them getting an interview are limited? How in this process of reevaluating are you reevaluating the efficacy of jobs mm-hmm. programs? Because there are probably some very good ones, and there are probably some that are basically, how do you fill out a resume, and how do you go to an interview?
Co-Chair Devlin, you're on fire. These are great questions. So it's a great question. You know, the governor had an executive order that really looked at aligning workforce programs. So that is a big part of this discussion is what's the role of the employment department? What's the role of the TANF jobs investment? What's the role of our WEA partners? And similarly, on the federal level, there's the recent WEOA Act that looks at kind of that aligned governance around workforce. And I think what's unique about that, because we align things a lot, but what the opportunity there is, what are we providing in the community, what are employers asking for, and how do we get more focused about setting people up for what the jobs actually are in the community and what the type of training is. In fact, just yesterday we were here for a Department of Labor grant approval, and in the hallway were our DHS local leaders with a WEA partner saying, hey, I just talked to an employer the other day. He needs people. It's a 10-week training. We'll pay for the 10-week training. Can you tee up people who are ready for that training to us? So it's those kinds of matches, much more focused than I think we have done in the past, not just in the jobs program, but on the workforce side. So those are the partnerships that we're really seeking to foster.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming up here today.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's bring Gary Blackmore back up, and we're going to move on to the next audit. And
questions about the next. Some, but not many.
Oops. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I brought along Sharon Blasey, who actually was the manager in charge of this, and she's probably more capable of running the machine than me. And who the also sitting in the front row is Shanda Miller, who was the principal auditor in charge of this. And I also neglected to introduce Ian Green on the end, who also worked on the TANF audit. So my apologies there. So let me give you a quick overview of kind of what, well, actually, as an introduction, this is another tough decision that we look to the legislature to make the tough decisions on, which is an education. It's another general funded program, a set of programs that go to the school districts that are a critical part of Oregon's future and workforce and well-being in general. So to the degree that we struggle with the issue of how do we stretch the resources we have, that's kind of the scope that we've set for our audits, not necessarily how much they should have, which is a difficult balancing act that we recognize you need to do. So what we looked at in this audit was the whole issue of the achievement gap. What is it? Where is it happening? What are there some success stories out there? So to the degree that we looked at the scores that students get from the OAKS test, which is the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills for eighth graders in math and reading, we felt like that would be a good starting point for analyzing the achievement gap. So we looked at those scores, and then we broke it down by the subgroups of racial or cultural categories. So what we ended up finding was that there were no improvements in the achievement gap over the last 8 years, either on math, which you see in the first chart, or in terms of... Oops, I need to get into there. Let me see if I can get you into the slideshow. There we go. That's the reading achievement gap, which has a similar, it's persevering, to say the least. And what those are, the achievement gap is comparing the white, non-economically disadvantaged students in the eighth grade to the economically disadvantaged in other grades. Or I'm sorry, in the same grade, but in other subgroups. So we'll go into it in more detail, but essentially we looked at the gap, and there was a study that was done by Oregon Chalkboard and the Eco Northwest that indicated that a 5-point gap in the achievement gap was the equivalent of 1 year of schooling. So when you see a 5-point gap, essentially like the math one up above, that's 6 points. That's over a year difference in schooling between the economically disadvantaged and the not disadvantaged. So that's one way that we cut the population for our analysis.
Excuse me, and just to clarify, it was economically disadvantaged regardless of race or anything.
That's correct. And the definition of economically disadvantaged is a student on free and reduced lunch.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
This is sort of just a clarification and just sort of a broad. The economic achievement or the educational achievement gap has not improved. Yep. But in both cases, the achievement level has improved. Is that?
That's okay. Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Devlin, you're correct. We have seen an increase and improvement in general. So that I guess there is some silver lining there.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to state things and other ways to state things.
That's correct. to the degree that we found that there was really not a change in the gap, we felt like we wanted to look into it in a little more detail. So we looked at it from the subgroup standpoint. And this is a little bit of a complex table, but let me kind of walk through the rows. This table essentially shows the reference group. The first section is math. And the first row is the reference group average score. So that would be the white, non-economically disadvantaged. And the score there for math was 241.4. So that's the number all the way across. When you look at the next row down, that's breaking out the subgroups. So the Asian subgroup, they actually had a score of 246.4, which is greater than the reference group, and so there was no achievement gap in math for Asian students. Sliding one over to the right, this is the black subgroup, black students. Compared to the 241.4, black students only scored 233.7. That's a 7.6-point gap. Again, if you look at that in terms of grades, it's a year and a half of schooling behind. Hispanic, 7-point gap. Next over, Native American, 5.9, Pacific Islander, 2.8. The next section down is reading, and similarly, Asian students had a slightly higher score than the reference group. Black students, 6 points lower. Hispanic, 6.6 points lower. Native American, 5 points lower. Pacific Islander, 3.9 points lower. So we're seeing the gap also in terms of those subgroups, not just the economic disadvantage. So if we, however, look at the breakdown for looking at economically disadvantaged and non-disadvantaged black students, we see an even more stark difference. So the light gray line at the top is our white, not disadvantaged reference group, I should say. The bottom line is the black economically disadvantaged, and that is 10 points lower. But when you look at the middle two lines there, those are actually the dotted middle line is the white economically disadvantaged, and the solid light blue line is the black not economically disadvantaged. So essentially what that says is white disadvantaged are scoring on the same, on par with black not economically disadvantaged. I mean, it's hard to deal with the double negatives, but what it essentially means is that there's a real struggle for black students to even achieve the scores that the reference group is getting, whether they're even when they're economically advantaged or they're able to compete in that way. So it provides, again, as Senator Devlin pointed out, a general upward trend, but not a closing of the gap as we would hope.
Sir, your column on the left, what does that indicate, the 222-32-40?
Senator...
The scoring?
It's the scoring, yes.
So basically, though, in a period of 6 or 7 years, the scoring hasn't improved remarkably at all.
Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson, yes, it's been a slight increase, but not a large one.
And would we assume that it should be a large one? I'm sorry. Follow up. Would we assume that it should be larger?
Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson, it's difficult to move these lines. These are driven by a lot of cultural and economic forces, and I think the changes that happen institutionally in schools take a while to have an impact. So I tend to think that it's going to take more years to get there, but we would expect to see some closing happening, and at a statewide level, which this is for eighth graders, but it's not happening as quickly as the growth has been.
Thank you.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So follow up on that. I mean, the slope of each line is positive. These are means. There are no standard deviations or standard errors of the means. There are no statistics applied to the slope or the points, right?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Harker, right.
Okay, thanks. To my original point?
Yes.
Thank you. These are statewide data. They are aggregated across all schools. Do you have similar data from individual schools so that one might look at these populations within a similar geographic setting with the same, arguably the same teachers and school conditions?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Harker, yes. The appendix of our report shows the scores for all the schools, and we did not count the schools where there were so few minority or subgroup students that we would identify identity there. So we had to leave some of the schools out, or they were just so small of a group that we couldn't use an average as a basis for comparison.
Do these same trends persist in those analyses, more localized analyses?
We actually went out and visited a number of schools that showed the gap closing, and we identified patterns, and we'll be talking about that in terms of strategies that these schools are using to close the gaps.
One more.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. Is the gap, does the magnitude of the gap vary much from school to school? Are there bigger gaps and smaller gaps between, for instance, blacks and whites not economically disadvantaged?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Harker, yes.
Introduce yourself for the record.
I apologize. My name is Sharon Blazian. I'm the audit manager for the Secretary of State Audits Division. To answer your question, There would be variations among the schools. These represent averages statewide. Mm-hmm. As Gary indicated, we do have school-level data. So, yes, you would see differences. We did not determine whether or not, though, there are regional differences. We didn't go into that. But we do have, you could look at school by school.
And these are in the appendix.
Okay. That's correct.
Thank you. Senator Devin.
These are results based on our current standardized tests. I don't think many of us on the dais up here, and I don't want to speak for anyone up here, we haven't had any testimony or we haven't received any information about what variations in these scores mean. You said that 5 points is about the equivalent of 1 year's education. But in general, by that same definition, if you're looking at an eighth grade reading, and that's what you have up there now, there should be a number that there corresponds to reading at the eighth grade level. And do you know what that number is?
I'm not sure.
The number has to correspond to something. If your first statement is true, the second statement would be true. Yeah.
Chair Vega Peterson. Senator Devlin, if they are 1 year behind, then it would be they're reading at seventh grade level instead
of
eighth grade.
Right, but is 240 about the equivalent of eighth grade level? I got a nod in the back there. So 240 is about the equivalent of the eighth grade level, is that?
I believe that nod was based on some knowledge that we came out of the audit on. So.
Okay.
Okay. We found the same pattern in reading as math, that again, this is looking at the black not disadvantaged are scoring roughly the same as the white disadvantaged. The reference group was about 7.5 points higher than the black disadvantaged group. Again, the pattern shows a general improvement, but the gap, it may be closing, but very, very slightly. I mean, if you squint, maybe you could find some optimism in the gap, but it's a long way out before those seemingly parallel lines cross. So I guess from a school level analysis, what we saw was that out of 120 middle schools, only 39 had closed the achievement gaps for one or more of the subgroups that we looked at and for one or more of the subjects areas, reading or math. So essentially, we found 29 schools closing the math gap and 24 schools closing the reading gaps.
Madam Chair? Yeah, Representative Thatcher.
I keep thinking about how they kind of went up in a parallel fashion. And one way I could see, which wouldn't be, I wouldn't think, a desired result of closing the achievement gap, but holding down the top and pushing up the bottom, and then that would close the achievement gap. So when you say the achievement gap was closed, did it just mean that the top, I guess, percentile didn't achieve as much, and the bottom percentile rose up? What happened?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Thatcher. We went out and visited a number of schools, and what we found were that they actually focused on every student. They did not focus just on those that were disadvantaged or of a minority. They felt like if they developed plans for every student and worked with every student, that student would succeed, and that was actually the biggest means of closing the achievement gap, and the students all benefited from it. And so to the degree that it was the lower line growing faster, but the upper line also seemed to be showing improvement. And kind of the five key themes that we saw when we went out, we went out and visited a number of schools and interviewed the teachers, the principals, and kind of observed what was going on. And we saw that these were kind of the common themes that they had developed and for success: creating a safe and positive school environment, setting high expectations and high support, and that was for each student. A lot of teacher collaboration, working together across grades as students are moving, but also kind of helping each other strategize and problem solve with certain issues, using data a lot, looking at the scores, looking at where students were struggling and helping them individually, and strong leadership. Again, there was really a feeling, and the back of the report is kind of an interesting look at a number of these schools and what it was like to walk in there and see what was on the walls in terms of kind of inspirational posters and things like that. So we really saw and felt that there was an energy and an optimism and a real leadership going on in those schools that helped the students succeed. So in terms of recommendations, what we did was we really encouraged the Department of Education to develop and analyze and report on this gap, and looking at it from using the measure statewide, looking at it at school level, and seeing how they can incorporate that gap analysis into more reporting. Regularly remeasuring the gaps and evaluating reporting on the state's progress. Continuing efforts to identify effective schools and to share that information around to other school districts so that they can strategize how to succeed in closing that gap. Also, providing technical assistance to schools and school districts to assist them, and essentially kind of continuing this work in terms of using this data in a little different way and looking at ways to close that gap and ultimately raise the performance of all students. So thank you very much for your time. We can sit down, and I think there may be folks from Department of Education here.
Yes, that's correct. So now I'd like to call Jan McComb and David Bautista up. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Vega Peterson and Co-Chair Devlin. For the record, Jan McComb with the Department of Education, and with me is David Bautista. He is our Assistant Superintendent of Education Equity. In light of your schedule, I thought that I would abbreviate our comments. The achievement gap has been the focus of the department for many years, and we've made many inroads in terms of trying to reach out to schools and affect their best practices. Jumping to the four suggestions made by the Secretary of State, by the way, they're always great to work with, and we really appreciate their highlighting this topic. It is one of the most important education topics really right now. They suggested that the department develop, analyze, and report an achievement gap measure statewide and at the school level for one or more grade levels, and to consider using a gap measure that incorporates the difference in average scores. Currently, the school report cards break out different student groups and show their scores. They also compare a school's particular student group with the state's average of the same student group, so you can compare how that a school is doing compared to other schools statewide. The annual state report card breaks out student performance by subgroup on a state level and reports what percentage of each group is meeting standards. Beginning in the 2014-15 school year, the department will start issuing a new annual report displaying a school district's achievement gaps. In the first year, we'll have achievement gaps in high school graduation, and then in the succeeding years, we'll add a new factor. We want to make sure that our data is all validated so we don't rush into this. The Secretary of State also suggested ODE regularly remeasure achievement gaps and evaluate and report on the state's progress in closing any achievement gaps. So as I mentioned before, we do have that annual statewide report card. Since 2009, one of the department's key performance measures has been how Oregon schools are doing at closing the achievement gap. ODE plans to slightly modify this measure because the performance of a single student in a school with a small minority population will unduly skew the statistic. To remedy that, ODE will ask the 2015 legislature to modify the KPM to instead set specific achievement targets for all students and key subgroups in the area of third grade reading, ninth grade on track to graduate, and high school completion within 5 years. The third suggestion was that ODE identify and share effective practices with school districts. The Quality Education Commission has researched effective practices since its inception in 1999. Since 2008, it has analyzed district performance given similar student populations. Once two schools with similar students but different performances have been matched up, teams of educators visit the schools and interview staff and students to determine how their practices differ. In addition, the Research and Data Analysis Office at the department has begun analysis of the achievement of students with limited English, focusing on when the students exited their English language program and its effect on high school graduation rates. We're finding that if English language learners were in a program and they exit before high school, they actually graduate at a higher rate than the white non-disadvantaged students. And ODE is also partnering with OEIB to study how funding and the use of resources affect low-income and students with limited English. And then lastly, the Secretary of State recommended that ODE assist school districts in implementing effective school practices. Ultimately, this is a capacity issue, but we do assist districts in a number of ways. We're intervening in the bottom 15% of low-performing schools through the Focus and Priority Schools program, and we'd be happy to come back and talk about that more at length. We've also developed an extensive continuous improvement network that has regional network coordinators, leadership coaches, school support teams, and ODE's school improvement person providing technical assistance. ODE also hosts an annual conference that includes technical assistance, principal coach meetings, quarterly coaches meetings, and also provides technical assistance. We did look up the score that Coacher Devlin was asking about in terms of eighth grade reading. And that's a 232 is meet standards. And David is here, and we're here to answer any questions you might have.
Co-chair, thank you very much. Vega Peterson, Co-chair Devlin. For the record, my name is David Bautista, and I'm the assistant superintendent for the newly created equity unit, which Deputy Rob Saxon focus his work on looking at this, closing the achievement gap. Our experience in academic research supports the finding of the State Department report audit, absolutely strong leadership. One of our tasks is to engage the leadership at the district level from the board to the superintendent and just asking, do you have an equity policy in place? In case you don't, we can support to develop that. That gives the opportunity to have in paper a policy that they will be looking monthly. Absolutely, we know that it's extremely important to have that data for every single student. That comes with the work of administrators, principals, and teachers in looking at how the students come in and how they're supposed to follow. In terms of teacher collaboration, the state has developed multiple opportunities to work in what we're calling professional learning teams, in which a group of school leaders, principals, and teachers meet together, and then we go over the work that they're doing. High expectations is something extremely important to understand. If we don't have those, subconsciously, the students are not going to be achieving. And finally, absolutely a safe and positive educational environment where the child, where the students feel safe and feel invited and engaged to learn. So that's our work.
Coacher Devlin.
I do have one question, and I think it's for both of you, and it's actually for the State Audit Division, too. Is in looking at this gap, one of the factors that I wouldn't exactly express it as being left out, but it could be a factor, and it probably affects a number of the subgroups, though not all equally, is how many of the students are in ELL programs. And obviously, if we put just ELL up there, that I actually know from another committee I serve on, the achievement gap would be probably considerably higher than what we're seeing here. But in this discussion of the audit, you're involved in the audit, Was there any discussion about maybe migrating some of that data for populations and how EOL might affect what the numbers would be? I mean, you've looked at the economic issues between, but there are very significant issues, obviously, between the fluency that a student has in the primary language of instruction that they're having, and if they're actually learning the language, which we all know from an academic standpoint may take up to, from everything I've read and everything I've been told, up to about 7 years. So was there any discussion of looking at this in terms of the, disaggregating some of the data in a sense?
Co-Chair Vega Pederson, Co-Chair Devlin, absolutely. We can, good news. We have engaged in work with Oregon State University in a federal grant for 2 years to analyze the data of English language learners. Okay. Understanding the situation, we are able to know and see out of the cohort of students, probably 63,000 right now, we're able to see that 70% of that cohort exit in what you have mentioned in around 7 years. Students begin to exit the program depending on how they came in with a proficiency in English. So they can exit the program at the first year, second year, all the way to 7 years. That will be at the middle school.
To clarify though, you were asking, maybe we can have somebody from the audit. There we go.
I appreciated the answer, but I think broadly, Madam Chair, the question was, did you make any attempt to incorporate ELL data in this and to differentiate populations?
Chair Vega Pederson, Senator Devlin, we excluded the ELL from our analysis, and so this was all the students that did not participate in the ELL. So that would definitely make the gap bigger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you effectively simply excluded those students, so these numbers relate to non-ELL, just to clarify, non-ELL students.
That's
and the gap
correct.
Would be sizable compared to these numbers, much more
yes.
significant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's an important point. Thanks to bring that up. Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you, guys. This was actually a really important topic that I'm glad that we had this opportunity to talk about it. It's one of the things that I think as we look at changing demographics in our state and where we're going in terms of our 40-40-20 goals that, if we don't address this, we're never going to reach those. And it's good to hear that there's positive examples out there on how schools are doing this well and looking at how we can duplicate those. So thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so the next audit will be our final, the ODOT audit. So Gary, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Gary Blackmer. With me is Sandra Hilton. She was the audit manager in charge of this audit. And in the first row is Kyle Rossi, who is the senior auditor in charge of this audit. So I'm going to go through this relatively quickly. See if I can pull up our... There, hold on. Oops, where is it? I can do this one better. Okay, let me kind of lay, this is a little different audit because this is more of a future-oriented audit. The others were kind of describing what happened or where we are right now. This one, we saw issues for the future of ODOT. And so to that extent, it's a little different approach. Essentially, ODOT is caught between two kind of serious kind of situations that have grown and are likely to worsen. One is that it's facing an aging infrastructure that's going to require more money to upgrade, to replace, to repair. It's also been struggling with uncertain funding for a number of years, and so what it's tried to do in order to address this declining revenue is cut back on its permanent positions. So those are kind of the environment that transportation has been working in. This gives you a picture. This is just bridges, and this is 10-year, these are decades of bridge either repair or replacement needs. For example, this bar here is the 2030 to 2039. And what you see is a huge increase in the repair needs. Probably about $5 billion in bridge repair needs are needed during that decade, and about $500 million in repairs. So, and because of the age of the infrastructure and its condition, there is a very large looming need out there for bridge investments by ODOT. So that's just one example of the kind of forces it's facing in terms of transportation needs. And we focused on highways in this case, but highways would include this area as well. So what it's done in terms of dealing with its financial situation is increasingly relied upon state bond funding, which is essentially borrowing for repairs now to pay in the future. For example, in the 2013-15 biennium, about 40% of its construction program was based upon the borrowing from bond proceeds in its $1.9 billion budget. So those, because of the short-term availability of those bond funds, it's relied more on using its staff for, hiring part-time staff, temporary staff. But what it's also done is it's increased the workload of those staff during the period of time when the bond construction has to happen. So what we've seen is that while they've been trying to downscale their staffing to kind of match the long-term trajectory of their revenues, the bonds have increased some of their workload in some areas to exceed the capacity of what they can do. So what they've done is during that same period, they've lost about 400 employees to retirement. And looking into the future, about 35% of the highways division's workforce is eligible for retirement in the next 5 years. So that was kind of the big concern we had, was that as its workforce is declining to match its revenue needs, what is it doing to preserve the knowledge and skills that they can carry on in terms of succession planning? So this gives you a little flavor for the kinds of turnover that goes on in the highways division. That it's been, in 2003, it was quite high due to the OTIA bond packages, which emphasized contracting more than the direct services. So a good deal of the design was outsourced. But what you see is a pretty steady rate of loss of knowledge over the years. And the resignation one is the most worrisome in terms of the economy. As construction starts increasing, there may be an interest in state employees resigning for better paying jobs, which can happen relatively quickly as opposed to retirement, which can be a little more predictable. So over and above that 35% in the next 5 years, there's also the risk of resignations as the economy improves. So what we saw was that there's a risk there around the capacity of the highways department and the knowledge that they have in the design and review and inspections of the projects to ensure that construction quality is long-term lasting, that we get the greatest value from our construction dollars. In 2007, ODOT hired a consultant to help them with succession planning, and many of the risks identified by the consultant are still present during our audit in terms of the loss of institutional memory. So what ODOT had originally planned was that it would hire temporary employees to help with the succession planning, but also what it ended up doing, having to use them for filling the capacity needs. And they weren't able to develop their in-house skills or pass them on. So rather than having hiring someone permanent, bringing someone back as a temporary employee to provide mentoring or guidance or training for that new hire, they were actually having to be reassigned to handle workload. So what we found was that there are tools out there that are allowed, like double-filling positions, where they could actually more methodically plan to fill positions with the idea that they plug workload needs that are out there, but also provide the building of employee skills. So we made some recommendations that they identify and document critical skills within the department that they need to preserve, who has them, in terms of the current workforce, looking at how long they can expect those employees to stay on and be able to kind of prepare other employees to step in when they think they're ready to retire or move on. That we felt like if they identify the gaps in the critical technical disciplines and develop those strategies, look back to that consultant report, and look at the staffing strategy allows them to respond to the fluctuating workload of the short-term revenues and develop at the skills and expertise at the same time. So that's a really quick overview of that audit. I know Matt Garrett is here from the agency, and we'd love to have him come up and talk about what they're doing as well.
Yeah. Why don't we do that in the interest of time? So, Matt, can you please come up? Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of Oregon's Department of Transportation. I appreciate this opportunity. I think Mr. Blackmore did a very good job of framing the conversation, because it did play itself out on two fronts. One is with regard to revenues and the challenges that we face. You articulate the need of the agency. But if we can drop down just one level more and speak specifically about state revenues, because that's the challenges that were before us in terms of the footprint of the agency. State revenues, again, are the monies that we can use to pay back debt service. The Jobs and Transportation Act, the investment that was spoken to, the opportunities that came in 2009, those are state dollars. The debt service continues itself out for 25 years or so. So there's a bill that comes due to service that debt. That is needed, or a takedown from the state revenue source, as well as just basic maintenance of the transportation system. We cannot use federal money to maintain the transportation system. We have a very specific federal pot called interstate maintenance, but that's prescriptive to the interstates here, and it's not a whole lot of money. So again, state money used to maintain the existing transportation infrastructure for the state. The third area is, again, the personal service costs associated with the agency, the cost of doing business, the footprint, so to speak. And so when you have givens like debt service, when you have a given to hold the condition of the system with the maintenance investment, what you start to see when you have revenues that are declining or plateauing, and that's what we saw during the period of time, that those state revenues were moving in the wrong direction. We made a simple business decision to align our revenues or align our expenditures with revenues here. We want to live within our means here. So that was the financial challenge in terms of the color of money that was affected by this conversation. You also had a masking effect with the big bond investment in 2009. It did kind of shadow that decline of the basic state revenues that were coming in. Now, we could have kicked the can down the road, and I would submit that the agency probably did that in the past. I didn't think that was good business practice. I thought we did have to live within our means. Now, what the audit does, and again, I will tell you the disposition of my agency specific to audits. Audits are very useful business tools, because you can always find something to make your organization better out of it, and that's what we see in this audit. They pointed to a deficit, that if you look at some of the long-term implications and some of the exposures and risks that exist, the knowledge base, the experience, the technical skills that exist today with the professionals at the Department of Transportation may migrate on. So how do you backfill? Our takeaway from this audit is we need to do a better job, and we concur with a recommendation that as we look at workforce and succession planning, we can identify those specific technical skills that need to be put in place to assure that we have core competencies to address the issues today and address the issues out into the future here. And that's the assessment that is underway right now. It's a fairly robust assessment in terms of looking at the technical skills and expertise that is needed. Again, those technical positions, those core competencies that would roster up a professional unit to deliver and oversee the delivery of transportation programs and projects across the state here. So we have, we will continue to identify those in our assessment. We look to conclude that activity probably toward the end of the year. And based on that, that's the jump-off point that would now, I think, put in place a succession plan that ensures, again, that we stand ready not only today to deal with it, and we're doing quite well. The financial challenges, the uncertainty of monies, not only at the state level but the federal level, will challenge us and will continue to challenge us, but we'll position ourselves with the best and most informed transportation professionals who make up the project delivery side on the highway portfolio. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much. Questions?
Only one, actually. Maybe two, Madam Chair.
Good Chair.
No, I usually spend more time on IT than I spend on audits, but you're explaining this, and I think you did a very good job explaining it. We both know that your federal revenue is in question. We both know that although a lot of the money didn't go in that area, a considerable amount of the ARRA money, recovery money, went into transportation-related projects. We both know that the legislature, in terms of our last increases in the gas tax, devoted much of it to projects where we bonded for those projects. And so your stream of revenue is pretty tight for what you have left, and what you can count on from the federal government is what rumors you hear.
Well said. Very well said.
And your cost of personnel is probably going to go up. And your debt service isn't a choice.
Right.
I mean, try to tell members that. Debt service isn't a choice. You don't choose to pay, your payments on your debt service. And just like many state agencies, you've got a very high portion of your workers that are near retirement or are eligible to retire. So the economy's starting to improve. This is a long question. But I remember a discussion from a while back, before the recession, where it was like, I'm having a hard time, and I don't know if the proper specialty would be a civil engineer with 5 years of experience out in the field. I'm going to have a hard time hiring a civil engineer with that experience for what I can pay him or her as a state employee. Are we going to actually revisit that? In a sense, is that going to be an issue for us in coming years as we try to replace this workforce?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, it's an excellent question. We are going to face that. We have to face that. Again, I think as a state government enterprise, we are given the charge to be a market-based entity. We are not. It's very difficult for me to attract the best and the brightest coming out of engineering schools, much less vocational schools, because I need electricians as much as engineers to deliver services here. But that said, for us to compete with the private sector from a financial standpoint, we aren't market-based. I think Mr. Jordan at DAS and the chief operating officer, I think he has engaged a conversation to try to better understand and align the discussion about compensation and classification so we can actually talk in similar terms as the private sector and truly understand, are we market-based here? That at least gives us a fighting chance to bring those young kids into public service and deliver the infrastructure for the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So that was our section on audits, and I want to thank everyone for being here, especially the audits folks from the Secretary of State's and also the folks from the agencies. This was the first time that we tried this. I do think it led to a more robust look at the topics we were covering, and so I'd like to see this continue. But now let's move into major IT projects. So we're going to start off with the revenue replacement. So can I have Eric Smith and Terrence Woods, please? Or is it just Eric?
Just Eric.
All right, Eric. Thank you. Please go ahead and get started whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Smith. I'm the administrator of the Program Management Office for the Department of Revenue. Terrence Woods regrets not being able to be here today. He had a family emergency pop-up this morning. And I do have, let's see, there we go. Can you get me, is it here? Nope. Gotcha. All right. I do have a brief update for you. So thank you very much for the opportunity to give you an update on our core system replacement project. What I plan to cover is just a status update of where we are. The things that we're looking at to be ready to go live on November 12, 2014 with our first rollout. That's 39 business days from today. And then just a little bit of a glimpse of the things that we plan to be doing after our rollout as we look into the next phase. Briefly, we're implementing a commercial off-the-shelf solution that will replace two-thirds of our core systems. We're beginning with our corporate tax, tobacco tax, and cigarette tax programs in the first rollout. Next fall, we'll roll out individual income tax and some other programs, including 911 tax. The fall after that, in 2016, we'll do our withholding tax program and some other small programs. And then in our final rollout in the fall of 2017, we'll conclude with the rest of our smaller programs. Total estimated cost at this time is $81 million. Current status, we have an independent quality assurance firm, CSG Government Solutions, who's been on board for about a year now. And they think that we are in very good shape to go live on November 12th. They, overall health, they see us as green. Schedule, we're on schedule. I'll talk about that a bit in a moment. The thing they look at is how are we managing risks and issues as they pop up. And with a project of this size, you're going to have a lot of moving pieces that are going to cause risks and issues. And our processes are in place to make sure we channel those for the right people to have the conversations and bring solutions to them so we can keep moving forward. And I'll touch on budget in a moment as well. We're doing well there. We also have our own project manager on staff for the department. She also believes that we are in very good position to go live. There are no material risks for us to go live November 12th. We're on schedule under budget, and I'll talk about scope in a moment. We have met the business requirements we need for our programs. As the sponsor and project director, what I'm looking at is the processes. Are the people who need to be engaged right? We have over 80 people working full-time on this if you take department staff and the contractors we have on board. And they seem to be partnering very well to be able to freely escalate issues, talk about them, resolve them, and move us forward. Regarding scope, all of the relevant scope requirements for the programs in Rollout 1 have been met. This is big for us because our goal going into this project was to find a commercial off-the-shelf or a COT solution where we would not have to do any customization. And I can tell you that we have satisfied all of our scope requirements without any customization, and we are very pleased with that. That means it'll be easier to maintain in the future and easier to support. The process that we have in place for managing scope is very methodical and has been working well. This is a graphic that gives you an idea of how we're doing for schedule. We have little schedule variance. There are some things that are taking a little longer to deal with. A number of our front-end systems, we have independent vendors who help us provide data capture and other services. Negotiating those contracts timely for them to do the work order changes to get the things we need into the new system are taking a little longer than we thought, but it looks like everything will be fine. There are no showstoppers with any of the work that's going on there. And the resources that we need to have available for the rest of the work, which I'll touch on in a moment, are available to do that work. With regard to budget, we are under budget. Two primary drivers for that. First is our data center costs. The ETS costs are lower than we had anticipated, though it's still early. We'll monitor those throughout the fiscal year. But the other one, the biggest one, is you gave us $3 million for contingency in case we needed that in this biennium. And at this point, we don't see a need to spend one penny of that contingency. And so that's a significant contributor to our budget savings. I mentioned quality assurance is monitoring us and thinks we're in position to go live successfully. Also work closely with the DAS Chief Information Office. Meet with them two or three times a month. And they see no concerns with us proceeding as planned. The types of things we're monitoring as we get close to our go-live date include our scope requirements met, as I've talked about, staying on schedule, testing is a large portion of what we're doing. Do you have a question, Ray?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to find the answer quickly here myself, and I realized I wasn't going to get it in time. So, you referred to lower ETS costs than anticipated at the time that we approved funding, if I heard you correctly. Attributed to what, and can we count on those being lower ongoing?
Coach Vega Peterson, Representative Harker. There's a couple moving pieces on the what. First is, it's difficult in the budget planning process when the data center is setting the rates for the next biennium to know exactly what the rates will be. So we used older rates when we first set our budget for this, so that was one piece. Mm-hmm. The other is, especially for this first rollout, we weren't sure. We knew about how many servers we were going to need, and we knew about how much data storage we would need, but we didn't know what the complete makeup of that would look like. In fact, we're still building it for certain functions, such as our research department that wants to take the data that we're getting and to be able to run analytics against that for compliance efforts or reports that they provide externally. And so there's things that we're still discovering about that, but it looks like we overestimated what we thought those costs would be on our end. So two pieces, rates were different, and it was a difficult task. I think for this next budget cycle, for 15-17, we'll be in a much better position to have a better estimate.
Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Thank you.
Testing is where I was at, and we've done over 20,000 test scenarios with over 99% pass rate. So the system has been built and is passing very well. The things that we're finding that aren't passing testing, we're able to move through the different channels to either reconfigure it or find a different business process that will take care of the need that we have. As you can imagine, with a project like this, data conversion is monumental. The methodology that Fast Enterprises uses, which is their solution Gentex we're installing, has many, many mock conversions, which we started in July with smaller sets of data, then larger and larger. And now we're up to full data set mock conversions from our legacy system to our new system. And then we look at, are there any anomalies in the data in the new system? Is it behaving the way we would like it to? We've identified 35 different types of data anomalies, and what we're doing is working through systematically how do we address those data anomalies. Data security, of course, is critical. We've been working very closely with our business partners, the IRS, who have very strict data security requirements, as well as the data center, as well as our own information security office, to make sure that we have all that we need in place to have secure data. And then we're at the stage now where we need to be training our employees. We have over 400 employees out of our 1,000 employees in our agency are impacted by Rollout 1. They've already begun training. They do computer-based training first at their desk, then they get into labs. We will have over 230 training sessions for those people before we go live on November 12th. In addition to that, the stakeholders that need to be aware of anything that's changing and all the planning that goes into what do we stop in legacy systems and then when we started in the new system is in our cutover planning we're dealing with as well. So that gives you an idea of the things that we're looking at to go live. After we go live, for the programs that are in Rollout 1, we will begin supporting that, no longer building and maintaining and supporting it. We will continue to provide user support for the people who are learning to use the system to do their jobs. We understand from other states, and we'll be either the 18th or 19th state to go live. Massachusetts is within a day of us. They may go a day before us. It takes one or two business cycles for us, that's a fiscal year, to run the system, to stabilize it and normalize it because you've changed some of your business processes and you have a lot more automation. So we'll begin that process. And then we do tax return processing beginning in January. We built the system for this tax year, but at the end of the year, as soon as we go live, we'll need to make the changes we need to so then we can start processing next January for the 15 processing season. So that's what we'll be focusing on for Rollout 1 programs after we go live. For Rollout 2 programs, which are personal income tax, states and trusts, transit self-employed, 911 tax, and senior deferral, we've already done, for some of those programs, begun data cleansing, account cleanup, and we have learned a lot about service delivery strategies that are available to us now with this first rollout, and we'll continue to mature our knowledge and then deploy those with those tax programs in Rollout 2 and officially initiate the definition phase where we start building the programs in the new system for Rollout 2. So that gives you a quick overview of where we are. Happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I believe you said that there had been no customization costs yet at all, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, that is correct.
Okay, may I just ask a few here?
Go ahead.
Okay,
yes.
Thanks. There must certainly be configuration costs, and I'm wondering about what kind of configuration costs there will be ongoing and how that's budgeted for.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Harker. So let's talk about implementation, and then let's talk about ongoing maintenance and support. Mm-hmm. We have a fixed capped price for the functionality out of this system, regardless of how much configuration it takes. And so we've established that, and they have no history, even with other states, of ever deviating from that. So we have a fixed price for that. And even if we had to do site-specific customization, that doesn't mean it would cost us more. We just want to avoid that at all costs because it's more difficult to maintain when you get service packs and version upgrades. And so it's just a goal to do that as little as you can. But we have a fixed price for the functionality that we need to bring all of our 30-some programs into this over the next 4 years. And on the maintenance and support side, we've already negotiated for the first 3 years of maintenance support after we've gone live, so beginning in 2018, what our price would be. And it'll depend on what we choose in terms of level of support on certain categories, but it'll be around $3.5 to $4 million per year. So $7 to $8 million a biennium for ongoing maintenance and support. But with that, you get all the service packs, you get all the version upgrades, and so you will, 10 years later, you still have a brand new system that's highly functioning because you've continued to pay to be current on the system. I hope that answered your question.
Good.
Yeah.
One more?
Go ahead.
Okay. In the configurations, is there the ability to set any flags that might help catch some of the types of fraud that the state has experienced at the hands of some clever defrauders?
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, yes, definitely. There are going to be more features than we even have today. Our current system does do a lot of flagging, too, but the system that we're bringing in not only allows us to continue to do that work and more, but we're a part of 19, by the time we go live, 18 or 19 other states that have the same system, and if they find somebody in their state who is trying to move a fraudulent return through their system, they can identify it and overnight tell all the other states, here's a fraudulent Social Security number or a business identification number, flag this return. And so what happens by being a community of states who use this system is we've expanded our footprint from just trying to fight fraud in just Oregon to across almost half the other states across the country. So there's some potential for us to be even better at detecting fraud with this system beyond just what the system will do for us.
Good.
Thank you.
Just I didn't ask this question when we met earlier, but obviously the real challenge is, in a sense, not that this level hasn't been a challenge, I believe it obviously has, is when you get to rollout 2 and rollout 3, which are your much larger programs. My memory is the number of personal returns that are filed on paper has gotten to incredibly low levels. The department has done a great deal, although it will still allow businesses to file paper returns, a great deal to move all businesses towards filing online. Are we going to see more of that on the personal level? And is that data going to be, will you be able to migrate that data instantly into the system versus, any intermediary or?
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Devlin, so we already process about 80% of our returns with electronic filing now, and so that data is readily accessible. We also key the data from the paper returns so that we still have a lot of data, but the ease and the lower cost for the individual income tax program to bring that into our system now will continue in the new system. I think the opportunity we have is for many of the other programs, even the small programs, that opportunity isn't available. And we'll be able to offer, should the programs decide that's the best way to do business with their taxpayers, direct file. And so we are looking definitely to move as much of the correspondence or transactions as you can with the department to more of a digital format in the future. And we will continue to sustain what we've already gained and hope to build on it for personal income tax as well. I hope that answered your question. Okay.
And I just had a question related to using a commercial off-the-shelf system. I mean, the benefits of doing that is that there isn't a lot of customization, hopefully, that you have to do with that, especially building something from scratch. But obviously, there's still work that has to be done in order to get it to work, you know, migrating existing systems. So can you go into that in a little bit of detail?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yes, the perception could be it's like buying Microsoft at a big box store and dropping in your computer, and it is an integrated tax system that is well designed and functioning well in other states, but we have to configure it to do our business needs, to meet our statutory requirements and our rule requirements and our business processes, and that takes a great deal of effort to be able to configure it. By building the tables, migrating the data, making sure the data interacts the way that it should, testing that. And so we've had, I think I mentioned earlier, we have 35 people that you gave us to be dedicated to the project full time, but then we have testers and trainers who come on for several months who are also nearly full time. And so we've had over 50 or 60 people, department people, working on this along with 20 or 30 contractors as well. So it's a great deal of effort. And when we get to the individual income tax program, it's going to take even more resource because we have much more data to convert. And the individual income tax program is one of the most, you know this, one of the most complicated tax programs in any state. And so there's just a lot of moving pieces to that we have to make sure we configure correctly to continue to meet our business needs. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. We're very busy the next 2 years. For the rollout 2 and rollout 3, it's going to be everything we can do to continue our current service level and get these next 2 rollouts under our belt.
Representative Thatcher.
I just want to say that maybe also look at whatever the IRS is doing for direct pay. For if a business changes banks, it's taking the Oregon Department of Revenue, I don't know, weeks before they can accept direct pay, and they're having to do paper. But the IRS, it's just like turning a switch. You just do some online entries, and you're presto changeo, you're switched over to that new bank. So anyway, that might be helpful.
Thank you.
People.
Thank you so much, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
All right. Next, we're going to be talking about the Oregon E-Court. So can I have Brian Baer and Phil Lehman. Lehman, sorry about that. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, members. My name is Phil Lehman from the Office of the State Court Administrator. With me is Bryant Baer, who is our Chief Information Officer and Director of our Enterprise Technology Services Division. We do have in the audience our State Court Administrator, Ms. Kingsley Click, and our E-Court Program Director, Christopher Stockett, if you do have additional questions. We were before you in February to give you a program update, so I'm going to run through some of this pretty quickly. I will spend some time going into more detail about our quality assurance report and our document access program, which we are making available in the near future. So since February, the big news is we had a successful go-live in our largest circuit court, Multnomah County, and Bryant will have additional information on that, but that went very well by all accounts. Our next go-lives resume in December, both here in Marion County and also in Douglas and Josephine counties. The program is still within our budget. We continue to see a steady decline in both the number and the severity of issues that we see in our go-live events. The absolute number in Multnomah was larger just because of the size of the court, but proportionally, that's a consistent trend that we've seen, and we're very pleased to have that occurring. So I want to spend a little time talking about quality assurance and where we are on that. We have an independent quality assurance vendor, and we've had that same entity working with us since 2009. So they know the program inside and out. They have a long history with us, and I think with you. LFO gets a copy of every QA report. And for those of you who've been on the committee for long enough, you will remember deliverable number 9 that you approved in 2012, which documented and you approved our system of how we address and respond to each of the findings and recommendations in our QA reports. And so we have a systematic approach to do that. We also have an internal quality control manager. We have an internal risk manager. Both of those people are intimately involved in the issues coming from the QA report. The QA also makes personal presentations to both our steering committee and our E-Court program sponsors. every quarter, or three times a year. So there's a lot of interaction between the QA and the program and the leadership in this effort. As far as the detail, our risk is high, but has been steady at that high level for some time. Several of those issues are simply what I would call structural. And we've talked with this committee before about some of those. We've spent a lot of time with LFO and also in our budget process to go through some of those things. So we have an aggressive implementation schedule, and you will see more details in that when Bryant takes over. But that, once you kind of get into that cycle and have 3 months between doing multiple courts, obviously that's leads to a lot of complexity and a lot of moving parts. Right now, in addition to the three that are coming up in December, we are working with 11 other courts who are at various stages of that preparing to go live. Staffing issues. The QA is concerned both about the number of people in the program, the number of people in the courts who are not only trying to keep their court operations running at a regular level and recovering from those reductions that we had in the 2009 biennium, as well as things like burnout, retirement. The other thing we've talked with you about at some length and in our budget process is the limited duration status of our IT program employees. And especially when this program, the implementation winds down in June of 2016, we want to make sure that we can retain as best we can our employees who have that institutional knowledge and are well-versed in how we do things and how we want things to go. But that is a question and an item that the QA has pointed out. As we move through the process and we continue to run dual systems, so we have our legacy OGIN system in courts, we have our new Oregon eCourt system in other courts, that adds to the complexity in both the management and the implementation. And so the QA has been pretty consistent in elevating the concerns on that, and that contributes to our high-risk score. And the other issue I would just mention is he has flagged the level of our post-implementation support. And so as we go both in a court and then we move on to the next court, they are keeping an eye on what kind of supports that court needs to make things go. We are in the process, and you will, for those of you who are in our budget process in the coming biennium, you will see requests as we move from implementation to maintenance mode, and the supports both on the technical side and on the training side that we will be asking for to make this system work and to continue to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of our court operations. I don't know if you had other specific questions about the QA issues or process, but I'll be glad to pause for a moment to if you have those, or we can continue through.
I don't see any questions at this time. But colleagues, I just wanted to remind you that we have staff from LFO also in the room if we mm-hmm. have questions around the budget for this project, too.
Good afternoon. Chair Vega Peterson, Brian Baer, Chief Information Officer, Oregon Judicial Department. Bumped head a little bit there. Let's talk about Multnomah, state's largest court. We ended up doing an extended amount of planning prior to go live. Normally, we're at the 12 to 14 months prior to an implementation, going out and making sure we're doing readiness assessments, technical assessments, power, computers, environmental assessments, training, change assessments. We ended up adding an additional 4 months onto that and went 18 months out for our state's largest court. And then we ended up leaving ourselves a buffer zone. As Phil mentioned, we were on a pretty good schedule about every 3 months, but we left ourselves we left ourselves 6 months after the Multnomah go live just to compensate for the size, complexity, and to make sure we wrapped up Multnomah very tightly before we went on to our next set of courts. And I'm pleased to report that that's on track. And Multnomah is wrapping up very nicely. Successful go live May 27th, four court locations. All case types went live at the same time. And as Phil mentioned, a continual reduction in our go live issue management system, or a go live identification of issues and what we're doing going forward. So we do have a couple of things that we've been working on, as Phil mentioned. There was a minor data conversion issue that occurred with Multnomah. We're 60% complete right now in our data conversion. That's 13 million records have been converted into our system. We have 8 million left to go. 38,000 records from the 70s and 80s had a wrong code, basically, on them when we converted them.
Can I clarify? Is that sure. just in Multnomah County?
No, I'm sorry. That's statewide. Oh. I'm sorry, Chair. 13 million statewide. We have 8 million records left to go statewide, 60%. So 38,000 records had basically a wrong code, and these were cases in the 70s and 80s. It was quickly identified. We quickly rectified it. We made sure that we posted that information and made sure our vendors knew that there was a minor data glitch in these 38,000 cases. It's posted on our website right now for people who had done searches to know that we've corrected it, but the search dates between May and actually September, they may have gotten an inaccurate result. We encourage them to relook at it again. Quickly fixed, and we're on our way. That's 0.17% of the records that have been migrated over. So I would consider that a pretty successful data migration so far to date. And we found no adverse impact. We have not had, we've had our ears open across the board, and we have not seen an, or heard of an adverse impact based on those 38,000 records. The second thing we're talking about is reports. And OGIN was a case register system. It basically acknowledged certain events or actions that happened in a case. We went from that to a holistic case management system, looking at everything from how it retains documents to how the system, how the case moves through the system. And so that requires us to rethink our statistical reports locally and statewide. So we're working with the teams right now to make sure that when we're pulling data that's comparable to what OGIN, but takes advantage of now this holistic look at the system. So we do have teams working on that, but that's taking some time for us to do as we're bringing more courts up. In addition, integration. So OGIN, again, case register system, very well done case register system, lasted a good 26 years. But that had it had a problem dealing with data at the data element level. The system that we bought is very robust at the data element level. So when we talk about integrations, sharing information with other agencies, our issue right now is we're beating them back with a stick. A lot of folks want to have and integrate our data from the government to private sector because we can get to that data element level now, and so we're having trouble keeping up with the demand on that, but we're working through that case by case. And so that is on that.
Representative Chair.
Oh. Thank you. With respect to what you just said about access to data mm-hmm. elements by other parties, early on, I think it was Yamhill County, there was, and I haven't had an update, or nor have I sought an update on this in quite a while, but there were some concerns expressed by private sector folks who had been accessing data within OGIN who were unable to adequately, to their satisfaction, to access data in the new system. What is the status, and I hope I've gotten that correct, what is the status of that particular issue now?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Rep. Parker, quieted down quite substantially, and there's basically two components to that. One, data element levels, and then two, now that documents are in the system, what does that mean for an agency to get documents remotely? Phil's going to cover the document side of things. I'm pleased to report that the data conversation has quieted down quite a bit. We've been able to work out ways to instead of more on-demand data, get them what we'd call bulk data. Mm-hmm. So they get bulk data each night that we can transfer to them a more complete picture versus what we were comfortable with providing through a web interface. And I say comfortable with because we're very concerned and very aware of even though these are businesses we have relationships with, what do we want to put out there? What is the potential of a data breach? How do we control the data going out of the doors? And as you'll hear from Phil, our desire to go slow. We're not the first ones to go live on Odyssey. And actually, California, most of California's procured Odyssey. Washington State and Idaho are in the process of going live on Odyssey. Every recommendation we heard from every Odyssey court was to go slow. Several courts opened up their door very quickly and then shut them once they realized data was going out the door too fast and unrestricted. So the conversation has quieted down quite a bit and actually has been very positive here recently once documents are coming online for the external parties.
So. Okay, thank you.
So public-facing services and statuses. E-payment has been around since 2011. I'm pleased to report that 22% of all financial transactions are being done online right now. It's available statewide in all courts. This was the breach project that we did between OGEN and Odyssey, where we wanted to get folks paying online, but we wanted to take advantage of that and OGEN as well. So we cleared a $400,000 project, got that online in 2011, and have been reaping the benefits for that ever since, because it wasn't just based on Odyssey go-lives, it was statewide for the courts. Processing about 11.5 transactions, or as I said, 22%, and it significantly reduces our staff time and how we deal with the payments. There's no cash coming over the counter, there's no checks, there's no line, as you'll hear from some folks waiting in line wanting to pay. It can all be done online through a plead and pay, and so that's been very popular. E-citation's been around for a while, too, with Oregon State Police. This is another example of an integration where we're trying to hold back the very enthusiastic folks. Oregon State Police, we've been doing this for a while. 169,000 integrations to date. I was a trial court administrator in Clatsop County, where two-thirds of our caseload was citations, and it could take a week from when the trooper wrote the ticket to it to get to the court, because they would bundle them, bring them to the court. We'd have to do all the data entry, and we would frequently get folks who would say, well, I got it today, I just want to pay it, or I got it, can I pay it tomorrow? I'm passing through. 24 hours, less than 24 hours, but we say 24 hours from when the trooper writes the ticket to when it's in our system, you can go online and pay for it. So very excited about that. It automatically creates the case, saves the trooper and court staff time. OSP likes it, but now we're getting multiple requests from counties saying we'd like to get in there too. In Multnomah, we do Portland Police and photo radar enforcement, but other counties as well are looking forward to getting in there. File and serve, that's where people can file electronically with the court. It's available in all the courts as they go live in Odyssey 60 days afterwards. We've had approximately 23,000 filings to date. It's mandatory for attorneys starting December 1st. And everything that we had heard from every Odyssey court, Chief Justice goes to conferences and talks to other chiefs. And one of the big things is mandatory, and make it mandatory for attorneys. We are doing that. The bar has been very enthusiastic about that, from my understanding. And so December 1st, that's when it happens. And so all the when they do that, it creates the case. The documents come in electronically, again, allowing staff to focus on other tasks versus scanning and doing data input. And it's improving consistency among the courts. You know, the courts are now getting in a very the Odyssey courts are getting in a groove as it relates to how it's accepted, what the translation of the data means between court to court, which is helping our external parties because it's making it more consistent for them as well.
I would just have to say that I was online paying a ticket this weekend, and everything seemed to work just fine with the system.
Wonderful.
Sorry, but we're live.
Yeah,
we're
wonderful.
I might highlight, too, that I've had three ride-alongs with the state police in the last month. I think it would be good for all the members of the legislature to understand how automated the state police are now, that they don't need to actually put a radar gun out the car. They can actually check the speed automatically of cars approaching them from both the front and rear, and actually they're doing almost all their tickets, uh-huh, depending upon if their systems are working, and they're good systems now, they're not antiquated systems. Uh-huh. They're doing them almost all on laptops, in a sense. Uh-huh. And so I assume that data is being migrated some way without actually the physical transfer of data.
That's correct. That's what narrowed us, co-chair Vega Peterson, Senator. That's the neat thing about it is people really many people want to resolve their ticket quickly, and having to wait a week or two for the paper process could be very frustrating, as the calls that I used to get. Now, 24 hours, it's there, and they can resolve it. And I'm glad the system worked, Coach.
Moving right along. Document access is another thing that we wanted to spend a little time on, and it's part of the answer to Representative Harker's question. The only thing, as Bryant mentioned, OGEN was a case register system. And so basically if you think of the legislative measure history, it lists the events and kind of not necessarily all the outcomes, but what the events were. That's what OGEN was designed for and intended for. And so court staff, just as a shortcut and to help kind of keep their work flowing, would use the notes field to enter a lot of information in that. And so a lot of people who got OGEN subscriptions were going online and getting that information on a regular basis and relying on that because it was the official court record. And so In the new system, the case registry is a straight case registry. It just lists the events, and then it leaves to other parts of the system, and especially in the documents, to get that information that used to be available in the registry system. So again, if we try to compare that to a legislative system, when the legislature moved over to its new system, you have not only the case registry, the measure history, but you also post the staff analysis, you post the testimony on your website. You did that in, I think, 2012 when that went forward, but you didn't go back and reload the old testimony and the old issues. We're doing essentially the same thing. As courts come online, they load documents for active cases into the system, and if there's a case that started before that, but and then once it gets scheduled for a court proceeding, that case file is scanned. So that's part of the migration piece that Brian was talking about. But in the new system, much of the information that our stakeholders and partners are interested in are in those documents and not in the case registry. And as Brian mentioned, the Chief Justice, both Chief Justice DeMunis and Chief Justice Ballmer, have consistently gotten advice, just be deliberate, be thorough, don't be in a huge rush. And so we haven't been, but we're speeding things up now to make that happen a little more quickly. So court documents, we also have a law and policy committee, which spends a lot of time trying to be very thorough, since we have, especially in the family law area, we have minors' names, we have dates of birth, we have social security numbers. In domestic relation cases, we have financial bank accounts information. All that is in court. It's one thing to want to go to the courthouse, ask for the file, and actively look for that information. It's another to be able to go online and just pull it up and get it. So that's the line we're trying to walk, and being sensitive to protecting that confidential and sensitive information, and also meet the business needs that we know are there. So we opened up as a pilot to designated government users. These are Department of Justice, these are district attorney's offices, law enforcement, people who have regular interactions with the court records. And so, for example, if an inmate gets sentenced by a court, goes to the sheriff's office, does not have his sentencing order to enter into probation, instead of, you know, go back and get it or calling up the court and say, can you fax it to us, they go online, they pull it up, and that's been, I think, a big work saver for them. So that's the group we piloted document access with. Next, about a month later, in May of 2014, we opened it up to any active Oregon State Bar member. And so that gives them a broad array of the case documents, again, kind of from this date forward in those 11 courts. We do not give universal access to all documents to all bar members. We do not have adoption cases. We do not have civil commitment cases. Juvenile cases, we do on an as-needed basis only. So if you are defending a juvenile case, if you are working in, if you have a contract for juvenile cases in your county, and then even on a more limited basis, statewide access to juvenile cases. So we're being very cautious and deliberate about on a need-to-know basis on those things. So we are ready now to take the next step, which is to add other authorized users, and these are typically going to be the people who already have OGIN subscriptions, who are getting court information, and I've listed some of them on the slide: news media, debt collectors, title companies, property managers, people, private investigators. We have more than 2,000 individual customers, some of which are bulk data subscribers, and those are the people who indirectly service that. So we will again, we hope to have that up and running by the end of this month, at least starting that process. We won't load up everybody. It'll be on an application basis only, so we'll get a little more information about what their business is, how they disseminate that information inside their business, if it goes outside their business, how they protect against unauthorized use and access, and then we'll be opening that up. That will be kind of the standard public cases. It will not include the juvenile and some of the things that have more sensitive and confidential information in them. So that's kind of where we are on the document access piece.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Coach.
I just wanted to state for the record that I very much appreciate the work that Mr. Lemon and the Chief Justice have done in this area and other members of the judicial staff. I've actually had meetings with Mr. Lemon and the Chief Justice as recently as this month. And I've actually had meetings with some of those outside vendors. And I think both sides are pleased with the direction that things are going. And I thought it was important for this committee to hear that, because I expected the issue would resurface. Mm-hmm. And so it's better that the information comes before the committee, even though I believe the issues are being resolved and satisfactory to all parties. So,
Madam Co-Chair, Senator, thank you. It's not the work that I've done at the Chief Justice. We have, you know, dozens of people working on these things. But I appreciate that. We are, as you know, this has been a tug of war and kind of a pressure on timing. Some of our larger customers, service attorneys, public safety agencies, and so when we say not yet, it's the end user who is also getting the not yet. So we understand that. We're moving forward. We hope that even if we can't meet every request and need, that we'll be taking a huge step forward with this process.
Well, and so I think the court understands, and all the staff of the court understands, that some of the stakeholders within the system obviously have need access to the data. Also, many of you have probably had title closures on properties that you purchased, and it's good if the title company has up-to-date information on potential liens that might exist. So, I mean, those are part of the stakeholders, part of the people that utilize the court system, and I'm glad that these issues are being resolved.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair, for your consideration, our last two slides. Just as a reiteration that we're starting our quarterly go-lives effective in December. Lane and Lincoln, with Marion County, Douglas County, and Josephine go live in December. Lane and Lincoln go live in March. Deschutes, Klamath, and Lake go live in June. Our court implementations are on schedule. We plan to complete our last court implementation June of 2016. Subject to legislative budget approval, there's a little bit of money left we need. And this is the fun part of the map, members of the committee. This gives you an idea of what kind of progress we made. The yellow is this biennium. And as you can see, we go full speed ahead with our planned closure of this project, with the implementations of 2016. Then we've got a couple of wrap-up things we need to do for the next couple months after that, and we're on our way. We're available for any questions you may have or anything additional information we can provide.
Thank you so much for the update on that. That was very thorough.
I just wish Washington County had gotten in there sooner.
I think Multnomah County was big enough for it.
I understand the good rationale for not doing so.
Okay. All right, next we're going to be talking about the state radio project. So can we have Tom Lauer come up to testify? Welcome. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Thomas Lauer. I am the chief engineer for Oregon Department of Transportation, and amongst my duties is the design and completion of the state radio project, formerly known as OWN. And for brevity, I will simply talk to the four major constituent areas of this project, and it is four separate portions. One was the upgrade of all the active radios within the state radio system, including OSP, ODOT, Department of Corrections, and the Emergency Management Office of the Military Department, forestry being separate, to a narrowband system as required by the FCC. That was completed last year. It required the installation of more than 5,000 mobile radios across the state, along with over nearly 300 mountaintop radios. That's completely done and functional at this point, and was completed within that part of the budget, within that budget. The second portion of the project is the upgrade of the actual physical facilities up on our mountaintops. It's a very hostile environment to any facility you put up there. Many of them were decrepit. Towers were undersized, under-maintenance, and had challenges. Most of that construction is happening right now as we speak, or earlier this year. There are a handful of towers that will be completed next year as we're not able to do permitting. And our construction season for the towers on the mountaintops is actually up next month. And we will probably not likely be up in there until March, April, or whenever the snows leave a mountaintop. So that's a critical component, because as we're done completing the mountaintop physical facilities, that's buildings, towers, security, emergency power systems, the towers are most important critical item, because we need to install the microwave system across the state. That was one of those critical technical problems on the old state radio system. The microwave systems dates back to the 1980s. Most of the equipment was delinquent, out of date, spare parts weren't available, and was a critical risk for the system coming down. It's the critical piece that links the state's emergency system together across the entire state and allows central dispatch. We have about 30% of that complete, and now as our towers are completed, we will be able to put the new microwaves, and which are also heavier, up on those mountaintops and expect to complete that through 2015. That leaves the last and fourth portion of the system, which is a trunk radio system designed to manage heavy congestion, which is a challenge that's been facing ODOT and OSP within the valley. That system has its first test bed in place within the Salem area. Three mountaintops have it installed. We have some vehicles ready to use it. We are installing five more. We will complete that testing through this winter. Next year, we will begin implementation, and some of that will fall into 2016. The project's on time, it's within budget, and we're completing it quite well. And we're doing it live while all the users in the system are using their system. So every component we replace has to be put in reliable, effective, and efficiently so that every user can use it and the system is not interrupted. We have a requirement with OSP and our maintenance forces that this system run through all construction, all upgrades at 99.999% reliability every day, every hour. At that, I'll finish and take any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you so much for the update.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm sorry. Just kidding. Come on back. Representative Petzl.
Thanks for the report. It sounds very rosy. I'm happy to hear that. We have had in the past, when I was sitting on the legislative advisory group or whatever it was called, where we were talking about this project in its early days, there were times where we had to really request the bad news. Give me the bad news. Give me the dark spots in this thing, if you would.
Well, the bad news is we're about 70% complete. All the design is essentially done, and we're in an execution phase. Our biggest challenge to date has been the mountaintop facilities this summer. It was something we didn't anticipate, that all of our costs for those mountaintops have been coming in higher than we anticipated. What we're working into a market that is, it's the telecommunications market. We're using the same contractors to build our mountaintops that AT&T and Verizon is using. So we're in a highly competitive environment, so our prices have been coming in higher. The bad news of that is we are going to stay on budget, and we are making the hard choices of, do we put in a new facility that will last us 30 years, or do we go into a facility that's somewhat smaller than we like, it's old, yes, we can put a new roof on it, make a more secure door, we'll probably get 5, maybe 10 years out of it. We can spend that money or buy a new one. Well, if we don't have the money for a new one, we'll fix up the old one and make it work. Future capital budgets and out years in maintaining the system will have to come back and say, it's time to have to put in a new building. This one's now finally shot. So that's the toughest thing we've been doing. It's been ongoing active management of what we can build at what cost we can afford to do it at. But we are committed to staying on budget at this point.
Madam Chair. Yes.
I like that commitment.
One of the things about this project, I think that you know well, Representative Harker, and actually all the members here, I think Senator Olson is the only one here that doesn't go back to almost the origination of the project, okay, is it went through many transitions. And at one time, I believe, the numbers were up into the $800-900 million level and going higher. And the legislature contracted the process back to basically the core of the system. And obviously, the responsibility for the system was transferred through multiple agencies also, and the Department of Transportation, because of its record of completing projects on time and on budget, actually in many areas, and was charged with this. And they've done an excellent job. But there's a long history here, and it's kind of the history it demonstrates when you take a project and it gets larger than what is realistically can be accomplished with resources that we have, the legislature contracted it, got it down to the core, even though you're not complete yet, and even though some of your costs are higher than anticipated because of an improving economy to some extent and more competition for, actually, as you're saying, the construction of your towers on mountaintops. The project is now under control, literally pretty much on budget, and pretty much will be performing the function that we hoped it would be performing. Is that a
yes?
And I remember some of those days, although I was fortunate enough not to be on that committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I had the opportunity, as Senator Devlin has, to ride with state police. Is this radio system going to allow the people that have to drive up on Mount Hood to be able to communicate with other people and be able to actually hear what they're saying?
Yes. In fact, the system they have today and the radios that you likely observed within your system are the new Harris radios that are utilized in a conventional radio mode. As we get the microwave system completed, it goes from currently it's operating in an analog mode. It will switch over to a digital mode as we have the entire system complete. That actually allows for greater clarity in the way the system operates. It also allows for the trunk portion, which for you all who are not radio geeks, and I wasn't when I started this, I would refer to the way our system operates today on a mountaintop basis, that everybody on that mountaintop is in a party phone system we might remember as kids, where everybody was in a party line phone and you'd hear every conversation that was going on. In the new trunk system, it's like having an individual or selected groups radio system that works on the same radio frequencies but filters out every other call. So if I were making a call to this committee or your group of folks, or more practically, if the SWAT team or the bomb squad or a narcotics squad were out operating, they would be operating on their own selected group channel, only listening to the folks within that group and not hearing all the rest of the traffic that's out there. It allows us to push more volume of calls through, but it also allows for a more selective and a more efficient system. So the quality is also going up.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. So we are on our last agenda item now, which is going to be an update on Cover Oregon. And we're going to have Tina Edlin and Sarah Miller come up. And I would also note that the new executive director, Aaron Patnode, is here in the audience as well, in case we have questions directly answered by him.
And Madam Chair, as I mentioned earlier, I do need to take off for a meeting. I hope to get back in time for part of this presentation. I did hear a portion of it yesterday on healthcare committee, but I will try to get back before this adjourns.
Great. Thank you. Thank
you. Okay.
Thank you. Get started whenever you guys are ready.
Okay.
Welcome.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tina Edlin. I'm the Transition Project Director.
Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. In my day job, I'm the state's deputy chief operating officer. I'm on special assignment as senior project manager for Cover Oregon.
So how we thought we would divide up this presentation today is I'll make some general opening remarks and talk a little bit about one part of the project, and then Sarah, as the definitely more technical person between the two of us, will talk about some of the technical adjustments we have made in this project. So first of all, just as a reminder, this project really has two distinct parts. It is the movement of the technology from Cover Oregon to the Federal Exchange for commercial clients. That really is not an IT project. It's really a project about business processes. The relationship between the carriers and Cover Oregon changes to a relationship between the carriers and the federal marketplace. Our job with this project is really to provide a warm handoff, to make sure that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is treating them well, they have account representatives, they're getting onboarded like they should. On the Magi Medicaid project, that is actually a significant IT project. It's moving the rules engine from Cover Oregon over to OHA, and it is where we have had to make some adjustments from the original plan. The goal of that project is to ensure that Medicaid clients have a seamless experience in applying for Medicaid and being found eligible. And Sarah will talk a little bit more about that. So the QHP transition, it is, as I said, it's on track. We've met our deliverables. We're the carriers. We meet with the carriers every week. Every other week is about the transition project and then operations in between time. The 15 carriers who are participating in the exchange have approximately 140 medical plans. Even though there's one less carrier, there's actually more medical plans in the market for the 2015 benefit year. They will all be moved to healthcare.gov. That's where Oregonians will go to shop for these products, have their tax credit figured out, have their and get enrolled in a plan. They can shop and get enrolled in a plan there. 10 of the carriers, and this number is actually dated as of the end of last week. This was up to 12. Carriers are fully onboarded to the federal exchange, which means all their products have been loaded up there. They've been able to look at them and make sure that they're displaying the way they want shoppers to see their products with all the comparative data and on cost sharing and premiums. Three now are in progress, and so we will, you know, obviously continue to work with them to make sure that they get onboarded as they should. They are all beginning testing. Some are farther along and really ready for production phase, but they're all beginning their testing phase of the project. So with that, I'll go ahead and do this as well. This slide really does show, we tried to put together some slides that show a little bit what the consumer experience will be like. And this is for the commercial enrollment. What happens is the individual consumer with an assister or a navigator, whoever, can sit down with them. They can either do it alone or with somebody to help them. They go to the public website, the healthcare.gov, and they actually fill out an application. They submit, they do their shopping, pick a plan, find out what their tax credit is so they can pick the plan they want, and they're determined eligible right there at that time. So they get covered in a single experience in front of the computer. They also have the option of leaving the computer with an incomplete application, coming back later if they'd like, which is important to some people. So with that, come on.
So we thought it would be helpful to ground the conversation in what the original scope for the November go-live was before we start talking about the alternatives that we're going to be implementing. And so this slide shows you on the left really four business objectives for the original plan for November. First, move the Medicaid eligibility determination engine from Cover Oregon back to the Oregon Health Authority. Second, connect that OHA system to the federal marketplace so that we could pass information to the feds and so that the feds could pass information back to us about applicants. Third, to implement what they call a MEC check. MEC stands for Minimum Essential Coverage. What that means is for applicants who come in through the federal door, there is an obligation to check and see whether they have existing Medicaid coverage, because if they do, they're ineligible for a tax credit. And so that MEC check was the technology mechanism in order to do that policy check. And then fourth, create a public-facing website that would direct consumers where to get service and create an online Medicaid application. The things that are listed on the right-hand side are equally important for you to understand as it relates to what the original plan was for November. So out of scope, we were not going to implement redetermination functionality. So for Medicaid eligibles, right, they get Medicaid coverage usually for a 12-month period of time and then have to be redetermined eligible to continue to receive services. That set of rules that are necessary to do the calculation for redetermination was never included in the base project that we were going to implement. Also not included change of circumstance. So for existing Medicaid coverage, if they have a circumstance change in their family that might change their eligibility, that was never part of the initial scope that we were going to implement. We talk about MAGI Medicaid. That's really income-based Medicaid, right? There are other we call non-MAGI Medicaid programs that are available to you if you're aged, blind, or disabled. We were never going to do eligibility determination for non-MAGI programs in the initial November project. And then most significantly for the consumer experience, in November, we did not intend to implement a self-service portal. And, you know, self-service portal is the portion of the website that never actually went live for consumers in the last version of the project. things that are functionality standard as part of self-service portals, creation of a user account so you can do like what Tina says is possible at healthcare.gov. You can start an application and then leave that application and come back and finish it. That's all functionality associated with creating an account, just like you have an online banking account that lets you retain some information. So that was all outside of the original scope. So then we wanted to talk about our experience with our previous vendor. So I think most of you understand that the state has severed its consulting relationship with Oracle, but continued to host both the Cover Oregon system and the OHA system at a place we call Oracle Managed Cloud Services. So that's a data center in the cloud that is where our equipment actually operates. And the transition project believed that it was really important for the Oregon Health Authority to articulate to our service provider what were the things we needed to do to be successful for the transition project. So we, on August 18th, the CIO for OHA and I had a meeting with a vice president from OMCS to say, really, OHA has four needs. We need a second environment, and if you can imagine, an environment is a just like you have rooms in your house that have different purposes, an environment is a technology place that has different purposes. And so we needed a second production level environment in support of the system that we were getting ready to deploy. And we needed that system made available to us by the 5th of September, 3 weeks from the point where we had our meeting. Secondly, we said we need technical assistance to connect that new environment to the Federal Data Services Hub. That's the portion of healthcare.gov where we would exchange information between Oregon and the federal marketplace. We needed to agree upon how we were going to work together. There are not sufficient service level agreements to let us understand when we made a request of our hosting provider, how long it would take them to process that request, which makes it very difficult if you're planning in a deeply technology driven project. If you don't understand the durations for each task, it's very difficult to build a plan. And then we asked for them to actually provide evidence of the plan that would show us how they were going to, at a very detailed task level, get to a second production environment available for us. So this happened on Monday, August 18th. On Tuesday, August 19th, OMCS sent technical engineers to our facility at Cover Oregon headquarters in Durham to meet with the Deloitte consulting team to review the technical architecture and specifications for why we needed the second production environment. And then they went home and consulted with their service delivery and operational branches. On August 20th, Wednesday, the vice president called me and said, we know now that we can't meet the September 5th deadline, but we have a team of engineers building a plan for when we can make it available to you. It was at that point that I suggested to Tina that it was time for us to have a conversation about mitigations, because if they couldn't make the September 5th date, our November 15th implementation was in jeopardy. So there was a large event that happened on Friday the 22nd. The Attorney General filed a lawsuit in state court. On Monday morning, the vice president of Oracle Managed Cloud Services called and said, in response to the incident on Friday, OMCS is going to decline to provide you a second production environment, right? So Wednesday, the message was, we can't do it by the 5th, but we're working on a plan for when we can do it. On Monday, it's no thank you. We're going to service you as an existing customer inside of the bounds of the current contractual arrangement that you have with us, and we're going to decline to offer you new services. And so the good news is, because we had taken seriously the lessons learned from the first data report and we'd been actively planning mitigations from the very start of the project, we actually had a pretty robust set of alternatives to be considered that we could have a meaningful conversation with our partners at the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So we met with them on Wednesday the 27th to review our proposed alternatives for November. And on Monday night, actually Labor Day Monday, we got an email of approval of our submitted mitigation plans from our federal funding partners. I share that timeline with you as evidence that we took very seriously our obligation to do mitigation planning through the entire life of the project, and we had pre-thought about the things that might be at risk for us. And so I'm here. The rest of the presentation is really oriented to talking to you about what those alternatives are. So this slide shows you really there are three buckets of work that we're implementing associated with these alternatives. So first, as it relates to the November 15 implementation, there's a couple things to say, right? November 15th is a magic date because for commercial individuals, that's when open enrollment starts. Because every day is an open enrollment day for Medicaid, it is a less magic date for the Medicaid program, right? We matched the go live for the MAGI transition project to that date because we wanted to make it be as least confusing as possible for Oregonian consumers. It's important for people to understand if they have existing Medicaid coverage, they do not have to go to healthcare.gov on November 15th to reapply and recomplete a new application, right? You get Medicaid eligibility for the 12-month period in which you're eligible, and so there'll be a time cycle in which we have to renew coverage for those Medicaid eligibles. But as it relates to November, we will implement OregonHealthcare.gov, which is a public-facing website that will have a number of screening questions on it. The answers to those questions will help Oregonians understand whether it's better to complete an application at healthcare.gov or to complete the existing application as the front door of the Oregon Health Authority. There are certain special populations. We talk a lot about pregnant women as an example of a population who would be better served by completing an application at our front door, because we have business processes around our eligibility determination that make sure that pregnant women get direct access to medical care and well baby checkups. And so that population actually, it turns out, is better served by our front door. But there's a large portion of our population that actually is better served by going through the healthcare.gov door, because the Oregon Health Authority has elected to be what we call an FFM determination state, which means Oregon Medicaid will accept the eligibility determination that healthcare.gov makes for Oregon Medicaid coverage for anybody who comes in and applies for benefits through that door. And so we have a process that we will implement to receive the determination information. So if you remember that original scope slide, we had hoped to have a two-way pipe between us and the federal marketplace. That pipe cannot be put in place until we have an existing system to receive the information. So instead, we'll use what we call a flat file, which is very much like the enrollment process that we use now at Cover Oregon, right? So Cover Oregon makes an eligibility determination. They create a file that's actually an Excel formatted file that gets put in a secure server location. That file gets downloaded, imported into the OHA system for enrollment in MMIS. Essentially, the flat file that we will receive from healthcare.gov will drop into the same system, and we'll make sure that none of those people are duplicate Medicaid covers, and then we will enroll them for Medicaid coverage.
I have a question. So is the reason for the lack of the bidirectional the fact that you don't have that second production environment?
Co-Chair Peterson, yes, with a qualification. We could take that information and payload if we had any location to put it, but right now the security of the pipe is controlled between where our current hosted environment is and the federal marketplace, and they wanted to sell us a service to create that pipe. And so what we will do instead is use the flat file until we can build a pipe that we control both ends of associated with relocation of the hardware.
Okay.
Madam Chair, while we're at it, there have been things I've heard that you might be changing the website portal for people or maybe I'm misunderstanding, for people to sign up. And there is a lot of confusion out there, at least with some of my constituents that I'm hearing, where they're supposed to go initially. And I'm hearing go to OregonHealth.gov or
Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, that they what we're trying to achieve here is a no wrong door policy, and that in that if an Oregonian for commercial coverage, every Oregonian should go to healthcare.gov. That's the federal website. That's where they can shop for plans. That's where they get their tax credit estimated. If they're not sure then OregonHealthcare.gov is going to be where the screening questions are, the local screening questions that will guide someone to the best door for them so they can choose, do I want to apply for Medicaid, submitting the fillable PDF, or do I want to go to healthcare.gov where I can be determined Medicaid eligible, but all in one sitting. So they can choose at that point.
I have a couple of pictures and just a few slides
that show
you the two differences.
Coach Chair Devlin.
Thank you. I'm just trying to get clarity in this. My understanding of it at this particular point is obviously you're transitioning the commercial market portion to the federal exchange. That we had in our current exchange, we had 16 carriers. 15 of those are going to continue.
Right.
We're now down to three that are not fully operational at this point. First question, although market shares can change, obviously new rates have been published for those carriers, are those three existing sort of smaller portions of the market? I would presume that they probably are because one or two make up the lion's share of the market. Is that correct?
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, yes, that is true. The one or two do make up the lion's share of the market. The three that haven't completely onboarded, one is a fairly large carrier, and the other two are very small. But again, I have no expectation that they won't be completely onboarded by November 15th and have their testing completed.
Follow up.
Yes.
My understanding, and I think you've done a good job of explaining, and I may not be using the correct terminology, but on the Medicaid side, we had hoped to transfer that to OHA. But because of our issues with Oracle, we're not able to do that. So the federal government has agreed to do basically initial screening of Medicaid potential recipients. Redeterminations, changes of circumstance may not be going through that system. But the question I really have here is, my understanding is the federal government has agreed to do that for some period of time during this enrollment period, and that ultimately they're not assuming that function permanently. Mm-hmm. And we will have to move that function some way, either with or without Oracle's assistance. We will have to move that back to OHA. What's the prognosis on that? And maybe it's covered later in your slides.
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Co-Chair Devlin. So certainly I can talk about it in more detail. A few things. The answer to your question about the time limitation is basically a 12-month period of time. So the alternatives that we took to CMS for discussion include implementation of the system at OHA by August of 2015. And so that's what we call phase two work. Our plan for the scope of phase two is actually here at the bottom, which would implement redetermination functionality, change in circumstance functionality, and an initial version of a self-service portal. So in fact, for the Medicaid business, who largest percent of their workload is actually redetermination work, right? Not new applications. They will get functionality faster as a result of this phase two implementation. And we have some more detail as we go through. So I didn't talk about the middle band here. So data center relocation, I have a slide that talks about this in more detail, but basically we have started planning work right now. There is a interesting nuance. So the Oregon Health Authority leases the equipment that the OHA system runs at in the Oracle data center. Cover Oregon purchased its equipment, and it purchased equipment in two locations. So its production system runs in an Oracle data center in Austin, and its disaster recovery system, its backup in case of emergency system, runs in a data center in Salt Lake City. And so the strategy is to go get the disaster recovery equipment, install it here in Oregon's data center, build a connectivity between that system and the federal hub in a place where we control the security and services that will be used. And it protects the investment that Oregon has made in the purchase of that hardware, right? We have a legal obligation as plaintiffs in a lawsuit to mitigate our damages. This is a discrete way in which we can implement the mitigation by going to get the owned asset and redeploying it for the benefit of the state. So I won't spend a lot of time on this plan, but this slide, but as you go back and look at this presentation, what it shows you is the business objectives for the project, what was originally in scope for phase one, and what the proposed implementation. Phase 1A is what will actually be implemented in November, and so this shows you each of the component parts. We talk about a couple of them. Let me show you, I want to show you the consumer experience slides, and then I'll go back to that data relocation slide. So for Oregon's Medicaid program, there are really two ways in to that coverage. So we have negotiated with our federal partners that people who come in through healthcare.gov, they will gather all of the application information necessary to determine Oregon's specific Medicaid eligibility, and they will actually make a real-time determination. So for consumers who go through this door, if you complete the application and provide all of the required information, you will know when you hit submit whether you're eligible for Oregon Medicaid or not. They will then transfer that information to us using the flat file that I talked about. We will go through and enroll them in MMIS, and our Medicaid system will actually send them a welcome packet that has a Medicaid card for coverage. Consumer is covered. That's a real-time determination.
And you may have said this, but how long does it take that to transfer the flat file?
So the flat file, we have to be able to receive it 7 days a week. It will be scheduled at minimum one time per week, right? So we don't know what day it will happen. So if you apply as a consumer on day one after we got the once a week transmission, it could be 7 days before that information would be transmitted to us. But we're working out the schedule with the federal marketplace.
And when you have the bidirectional transfer, how is that going to decrease the amount of time?
Yeah, it decreases the amount of time significantly, right? Because then we're in full listening mode all the time, and they schedule a transmission multiple times in the week. So that's an enhancement. If you come to Medicaid through the OHA front door, which means you would go to OregonHealthcare.gov, you would answer the screening questions. The screening questions would say you're actually better served by completing our application. We will use effectively the existing application for Medicaid coverage. And a person will complete that application, they'll hit the submit button, and then it goes into our normal processing process. Now, what happens is that's not a real-time eligibility determination, right? You all know that the information is taken from that application, it's data entered into the Cover Oregon system, Cover Oregon determines the eligibility, and then passes a file to the Oregon Health Authority so that that individual can be enrolled in MMIS. So the consumer will apply, they'll hit submit just like on the federal, but they won't have a real-time answer. The answer will be delayed, but then they'll get a eligibility determination notice from the existing system, and then they'll get a new enrollment packet from MMIS, again getting coverage. So in both cases, right, to Tina's point, there's not a wrong door. You get coverage either way if you're eligible. The question is, how fast does that coverage come, and how many wraparound services do we put with that coverage in terms of being special population? Obviously, the existing process for us has operational considerations from a budgetary perspective. So I think actually one of the benefits of this 12-month grace period that we have with our federal partners is they are interested in helping us with some portions of the redetermination population. So because there isn't this two-way loop, right, that allows us to give information back to the feds, they are worried about people who come in through the healthcare.gov door, get sent to OHA for full determination. When we make that determination, if we determine them ineligible, our normal notice would say, you're ineligible for Medicaid, please go to healthcare.gov to apply. And you could get into a looping scenario, right? Because we can't give back information to our federal partners about what our determination was. As a result of the absence of that and the option that we have to implement, the Fed said to us, we want to make the consumer experience the best as possible. So for example, there's a portion of the population that we put on using the fast track process. They're going to allow us to send a portion of the fast track applicants direct to healthcare.gov so that they'll only have to complete an application one time. And so from the perspective of being able to minimize the operational considerations, I think that mitigation helps us actually minimize the ongoing operational expenses associated with the existing process. Now, the downside is because we don't have a system to deploy that automates that process until now August, that process will have to continue for longer than I think anybody initially imagined. And so I think collectively, OHA, the Transition Project, and our partners at Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services are interested in minimizing the amount of folks who have to go through that existing hybrid process, which is why we have added additional screening questions to direct more people to healthcare.gov. So I flipped by this slide. I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about what data center relocation means. So I told you that the Oregon Health Authority currently leases their equipment. Cover Oregon currently owns their equipment. The OHA contract for hosting expires on February 28th of 2015. The Cover Oregon contract expires on March 31st of 2015. And so we are working through a process to figure out how to configure and design the installation of the Cover Oregon hardware in Oregon for the benefit of the Oregon Health Authority. And that technical design process is different than the technical architecture overview that the state CIO's office has us working on. But in basic strategy, we will relocate first the disaster recovery, the emergency backup equipment that Cover Oregon has at Salt Lake City. We will install it in Oregon at Enterprise Technology Services. Then we will work to migrate the environments that exist on the leased equipment for Oregon Health Authority onto that equipment as the foundation for the system that will run in the future. Then when we're done with the production system for Cover Oregon, we will send a truck to go pick up the equipment in Austin and install it in Oregon as well. And so then we'll have a lot of super high-tech souped-up hardware that can both service the Oregon Health Authority for the transition project, but also support integrated eligibility in the future, right? So there'll be a lot of extra capacity on that equipment that can be used for future eligibility projects.
I'm sure.
Yes.
Is that are those movements, are they calculated in your budget?
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson, we are working on the budget implications of those. We have had a team, a cross-agency team of people put together making budget estimations about what both the work to relocate that equipment will be, the costs associated with that, but also the ongoing operational costs. So to be clear, right, Cover Oregon and the Oregon Health Authority each pay our current web hosting provider $2 million a quarter to host this equipment. And certainly, I don't have the total specifications. I'm sad that Representative Harker isn't here because I understand he asked a question in the policy committee yesterday about what the comparison costs would be. We don't have the full specifications, but from a straight co-location perspective, locating at Oregon's Enterprise Technology Services for one frame of equipment, about $4,200 a month. We got Deloitte to give us estimates for two third-party data centers, right, because that was the comparator that he wanted. And one data center was $4,100 a month compared to our $4,200 a month, and the other data center was $5,000 a month. Now, please understand that that is like an apples-to-apples comparison just for floor space, power. It doesn't involve any of the other services. My $2 million representation has a lot of services built into it. But as I understood the representative's question, it was a comparison, right? If you're going to put it in Oregon State Data Center, how does that compare to a third party? And it's actually a very comparable price point from a straight co-location perspective. So we're building the budget, Senator, is the long answer.
Short answer is you don't know.
And the short answer is I don't have a number for you here today.
Okay. Follow up. Where will these units be placed physically?
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson, Enterprise Technology Services has two alternatives. There is a state data center, right, that's on Airport Road, but Enterprise Technology Services has also professional service agreements with other data centers in Oregon. And so we're having conversation with one of their subcontractors, Easy Street, which has a data center in Beaverton that may be better suited for this equipment. So to be clear, the Oregon Health Authority's contractual relationship will be with Enterprise Technology Services no matter what. It will either be located at Airport Road or at the Easy Street facility in Beaverton.
One follow-up. When you review these positions, these physical components, these physical places, in your review, did you take into any circumstance for the Cascadian subduction faults or anything like that? Or because if it goes, you're putting in a place it's going to go.
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Olson, I really appreciate the question because data center people care more about Cascadia subduction zones than I can imagine, right? We have deliberate strategies to separate out our disaster recovery from where production environments are. And so the short answer to your question is yes, absolutely. It's on the list of things we're considering.
And just to clarify, so right now they're taking equipment that's servers that are in two different locations and thinking about combining them and putting them in one location?
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, it depends on how we architect the equipment that comes. Mm-hmm. If we need the capacity in total that both sets of equipment offer for the long-term need of the project, we're likely to locate those in the same place. There are other alternatives for disaster recovery that don't involve the super snazzy EXA hardware. But if we can meet the total capacity need that we anticipate in service for the long-term use of this system with just the one set of hardware, then, you know, the Enterprise Technology Services has a backup location, for example, in Helena, Montana. We might relocate the other equipment in Helena and use that as a backup location. There are several other DR alternatives, pardon my acronym, disaster recovery alternatives on the table. And so it depends on what we decide about capacity of the equipment compared to the anticipated business need of the future. What we want to do is locate the assets where it makes the most sense and use appropriate disaster recovery strategies that minimize cost.
Okay. It would just be hard to recover from a disaster if all your stuff is in place.
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, in fact, if the Cascadia subduction zone happens at the data center where I put all of my EXA equipment, then I have to be sure to be able to run the system that is in backup somewhere else. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, I'm well-versed in that particular issue.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, going back to your slides on in your presentation, I think slide number 4, you kind of have a flow chart. I hope I have the right the numbers correspond, but on my iPad, it's number 4. And then up to 11, your flow charts.
Yeah.
Can you give an approximate range of time it takes from a person sitting down at their computer on step 1 to becoming covered?
So on this, pardon me, Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Thatcher, for this experience, we saw a demonstration of what an Oregonian would see as it related to completing an application. And it in all good questions, the answer is it depends. If you come to the computer with all of the information that you need to create an account, because there are lots of unique data elements that you have to do to prove you are who you say you are. And so one of the things we're working on from a project perspective is creating a checklist of, before you go down to apply, here's the list of information you need to have gathered about yourself. So if you have all of that information to create an account, and you have all the information about the people in your household who you might be applying for coverage for, I think the estimate is about 20 minutes it would take you, between 20 and 45 minutes to complete the application, right? There's a large number of questions that you have to provide information about, but that's consistent for everybody. That's not unique because of Oregon's implementation. And then, you know, the real benefit of this piece is if you answer all the questions and give them all the information, then you get a real-time eligibility determination.
Okay, and I want to know what, thank you, follow-up, on the other scenarios as well. So what, if I understand correctly, I sit down at the computer, I have all my information, 20 minutes later I'm covered, next day or that, even that day I can utilize that coverage.
Co-Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Thatcher, what I'm not clear on is how long it takes you to get your actual insurance card from the carrier. So you've picked, you've enrolled, you have to make a premium payment, and then your coverage is effective to that date, but how long it takes you to get the card in the mail so that you could go to the doctor is not clear to me.
Representative Thatcher, the important part there is you do have to make your premium payment for the coverage to be effective.
Okay. And that can be done on
that
can be done online also, so you are covered. Or I'm hearing something else too.
Co-Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Thatcher, I'm out over my skis about where exactly that payment happened, so I'd prefer to take the question and follow up in writing on that. We saw the demonstration, which basically went all the way through your eligibility determination, but because the shopping part wasn't available in the demonstration that we saw, you know, you couldn't actually pick a fake plan and pretend to enroll. I don't know where the premium payment happens.
I was wondering if Aaron knows.
I don't know.
Do you want to
come on up? These are Cover Oregon.
Yeah.
Yes. Not transition questions.
And if you could introduce yourself for the record,
sure.
Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for purposes of the record, my name is Aaron Padnote. I'm executive director of Cover Oregon, Oregon's health insurance marketplace. So to address the question, through healthcare.gov, part of the connectivity work that the carriers are establishing, and this specifically relates to the commercial population, is the ability to actually exchange financial information. So it is the payment mechanism. It's a portion of the testing that's happening. So the payment does need to be made in order for that commercial coverage to be effectuated. It's part of the data that we actually reported in yesterday's reports to the committees. So.
And so just to clarify, it can or cannot be made online, or it has to be just mailed.
So, members of the committee, it can be made online through healthcare.gov for commercial coverage. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
No. I just want to make sure I was understanding because that's what I'm hearing.
Stay here.
Madam Chair,
if I may.
Sure. Just 1 second. I just want to make a note of the time that we are after 5 o'clock. So I appreciate the committee's patience, and we're going to stay a little bit longer to get through the material.
We get time and a half, don't we? So, to clarify this in my mind, you get on the computer, you fill out all your information, if you have it all, and then you're able to go right to a portal that will allow you to pay the insurance company you chose. And once they've received the payment, it's predicated on their time lag gap to get the card back to you. But once you make that payment, then you're technically covered.
So, Co-Chair Vega-Peterson, members of the committee, that's correct. There are dates established by which a consumer has to make that payment in order for the coverage to become effective the first of the following month. So, we'd be happy to get that information and provide it back in written form so you have it as a resource for conversation.
Follow-up. So, that's a little bit different than what Representative Thatcher mentioned. You said they would be covered, but you said now you just clearly said it's the first of the next following month. So there could be, they could do this on the 2nd of September, and they wouldn't be covered until the 1st of October. So they'd have a gap of 29 days without coverage. Is that correct?
So Co-Chair Vega-Peterson, members of the committee, that is correct. So I misspoke before. My apologies. It's a very complex process. So, and as it relates to this upcoming open enrollment period, the way that this becomes extremely important is that consumers will have between November 15th and December 15th of 2014 to enroll in coverage that becomes effective January 1st of 2015. So the 15th of the month is really the cutoff date by which a consumer has to make the decision whether they would like coverage for that upcoming month. So if you purchase on February 15th, your coverage will start March 1st. If you purchase on February 16th, your coverage potentially will not start until April 1st because you've missed the cutoff for March effective coverage.
I'll follow up on that then. Sorry.
Follow up.
That being said, if you come in on the 16th and you make your payment, do they take hold of your funds on the 16th? Or do they take hold of your funds on the 1st of April? Because that's a six-week gap that your funds are gone and you're getting no coverage for it.
So, Co-Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I don't know the exact answer to that question, but we'd be happy to get the answer for you and report
Please
back.
Please do.
Yeah.
Co-Chair Devon.
This area hasn't been touched on yet, but obviously an issue that came up earlier in earlier discussions was the need for current enrollees in the commercial market to re-enroll through the system, and now actually to re-enroll, I believe, probably through the federal exchange. Their coverage currently, if they're covered, if they've kept their payments, if their circumstances haven't changed, will not expire until January 1st of next year, is my understanding. But we were getting different communications about the re-enrollment process for those people. And to be honest, sometimes that's a little bit unusual for people, but for many people that have coverage, they, as a matter of process, have to go through an open enrollment period to re-enroll literally every year. So what's happening with the people that are already enrolled in the system and in the commercial market?
Would you like me to take that one?
Yeah, sure.
So Co-Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, the reason I asked if they would like me to take this one is it's kind of a shared responsibility between the Transition Project and Cover Oregon operations. So to answer your question, yes, people will need to re-enroll if they have purchased 2014 coverage that ends December 31st of this year. So given our transition to use healthcare.gov as the website through which consumers can purchase insurance, we are unable to transfer our data to healthcare.gov in a timely manner that would allow an auto re-enrollment process that traditionally would happen if the technology had been working. That being said, there is action that every commercial consumer that's purchased 2014 coverage will need to take in order to re-enroll for 2015 coverage. So that's the current state of things. So the opportunity, though, is that the design of the Affordable Care Act was to allow consumers the opportunity to continually shop based upon the criteria that were important to them given the open enrollment period. So while we do know that this is an inconvenience for the consumers that have enrolled in 14 coverage, it is an act that they will have to take for 2015 coverage.
Senator Devon.
Was there a follow-up or what?
I saw Tina trying to
jump in.
Sensory perception.
Co-Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I just wanted to make a point of clarification that I think gets lost sometimes, is that for Medicaid clients, this is very different. In Medicaid, your coverage is effective the date of your applications because there's no payment that changes hands. So I think that's important for people to know, that it's effective the date of they're found eligible. For Medicaid clients, they also do not need to re-enroll. We're shifting new applications to healthcare.gov for this year. Current people who are currently covered do not need to re-enroll except when their annual Every year you get 1 year of coverage, and then you have to re-enroll at that time. But November 15th is not a date Medicaid clients need to go in and re-enroll.
Yes.
Separate issue that hasn't come up is that there is some discussion, which I think would be normal. Obviously, the crucial thing here is on the commercial market is that Oregonians be able to get on the system, go to the federal system, be able to enroll. And that has to be available by November 15th. Mm-hmm. I mean, there really isn't an alternative to that. But the other question I had was, my understanding is, and this is not necessarily a negative, but the federal system is actually having to make some changes too in their system. What are we hearing in terms of the federal exchange, which has not had the same level of difficulties as our state exchange, but did have a considerable level of difficulty when it came up, in terms of it operating properly?
Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Devlin, it's fun when you ask a question, we look at each other and say, okay, which one's going to take it? The answer to your question,
is probably twofold. We have regular weekly, twice a week, actual conversations with the folks who are working on the FFM implementation. That's the part of Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services that is called the Office of Information Services. And so we regularly have dialogue with them about how's their experience. Those are the people who we said, can you show us a demonstration of the system? Can you show us the test results from an Oregon Medicaid eligibility determination? As an example. And so we have a dialogue with them about how their experience is going in the same way that they ask us about how our transition project work is going. I think, you know, the national media has covered sort of two big things happening at the federal level, right? They're changing the look and feel of the front end of their website. And so that project, I understand, is generally on schedule. And then the recent news stories about the, you know, security implications of people accessing information at healthcare.gov has them making security enhancements appropriate to address those issues. So like all IT projects, right, they have risks. They have issues that they have to mitigate to address. But I think the position that we find ourselves in for this state is that, you know, the system works for 36 other states, right? Citizens of those states apply for commercial coverage and in most states Medicaid coverage and receive eligibility determinations. And so while certainly it's not going to be all roses, you know, you jump from one frying pan, hopefully not into the fire, but into a different frying pan. We believe that the service that consumers are getting from healthcare.gov is, you know, better than the service they were getting in our exchange process. And so the good news is we're having those conversations transparently. We're asking them about the things that they're encountering. When we tell them about the risks on our project, they're telling us about the pain on their project. And so it's not being hidden from us, right? And it's servicing 36 states. We'll be the 37th.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
As long as we're here, I need to ask these questions. Cover Oregon is still in effect. What is the per person charged for insurance right now?
So it's a, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's a nuance to how to answer this one, and that's because the question is phrased as, what is the administrative charge right now? So as it pertains to 2014 insurance products, the charge is $9.38 per member per month. And that's built into the carrier's premium that they charge for their products. The nuance is that the administrative charge has also been set for the 2015 plan year. So for products that would be sold that cover 2015 benefits, the administrative charge is $9.66 per member per month.
Thank you. Follow up. Since we've taken Medicaid and put it here and we've taken healthcare and put it there, could you explain why you need $9.56 a month?
So, Madam Chair, members of the board, the $9.66 for 2015 was set based upon the idea that there would need to be an operating reserve built for the organization in addition to funding that was required to cover the actual operation of Cover Oregon. In that assessment process, the setting of that assessment takes place in the first part of the year leading into when that assessment comes into effect. So we will be going into the assessment setting process for 2016 coverage starting in January of next year. Obviously, it's a conversation that will be much different in the coming year given the direction that Cover Oregon will be going and the functions of the marketplace. We will not have a large technology portion of our business that we will need to support. So we'll look forward to having those conversations with decision makers come January of this coming year to set the rate for 2016.
Paula, what is your budget for the rest of the year?
So total grant dollars for 2014 were estimated, the drawdowns were estimated to be $90 million. For the past 2 months, we've actually come in under budget for what our anticipated spend would be for those months. We'll continue to track towards those goals. But the grant funding that was available for the 2014 calendar year was $90 million.
How much do you have remaining?
Approximately $20 million.
And will you be using all of that in the last 4 months?
We anticipate coming in under budget for the remainder of the year. Any budget, any amount that we come in under budget is placed into contingency for the organization. However, those dollars will not carry over to fund future operations of Cover Oregon, as they're federal grant dollars that were given to us to establish the exchange.
Thank you. Okay. I want to make sure we covered everything from the technical and IT perspective.
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, there's just one more slide I'd like to show you all, which is the summary scope for phase two. So in order to meet the timeline that the our federal partners have allowed us to use these alternative options, we basically got a 12-month extension. And we need to then implement the scope from original November plus redetermination, change in circumstance, functionality, and a self-service portal by next August, which means we are starting now detailed requirements planning for phase two, the new version of the project. And so this is a list of the functionality for scope that will be in phase two. The blessing that we find ourselves in is that our current contract with Deloitte Consulting has a flexible pot of hours to plan for anticipated unintended plans. And so we're using that body of hours to do the planning work that will result in a new deliverable-based fixed-price contract for the phase two implementation. And so the same rigor you saw us apply to our work in contracting with a professional service vendor for phase one, we will do again for phase two, and we're beginning that planning work. Of note, because you guys care about process perspective, we will fill out a new information resource request and a business case with the Office of the State CIO for both the data center relocation work and for the new phase two work. And so it will be subject to Mr. Pettit's stage gate process, and we will go through those gates as appropriate for the new work. And so the last slide that I have just shows you the basic time frame associated with each of those phases, right? So we'll go live for the phase 1A on November 15th. We begin planning work to relocate the data center and do simplification of the architecture. And then in October, we will begin planning work for phase two and implement a fixed price deliverable based contract to implement that portion of the project.
Senator Devlin, Co-Chair Devlin.
One of the questions that's obviously going to be asked in the near future is that knowing that there's going to be still an issue out there that's probably more of an OHA issue in terms of the ultimate transfer of the Medicaid approval process back to OHA after this transition year, having mm-hmm. the federal government operate it. What functions, if you were to define them, will stay under Cover Oregon? Mm-hmm. And the harder question, which is, I think, the question that people expect to be asked. If the board decides, the Board of Cover Oregon decides basically that their will is to transfer the functions of Cover Oregon back to state government, whether it's in OHA, the insurance division, or some combination of the two, or the legislature decides that it should be transferred back, what plans are being made for that? Because the timing of that, the most crucial thing now is that the transfer to the federal exchange occur for commercial approval. Obviously, we need the initial entry point for Medicaid, but contingency plans are something that sometimes I think in discussions in previous administrations, and you honestly have only been here a few months, if that. I mean, a few weeks in terms of actually being effective. What contingency plans are being made for that?
So, Co-Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, contingency planning is extremely important to me. So, prior to coming to Cover Oregon, I worked on the carrier side and actually participated in the IT advisory committee that ultimately made the recommendation to the board to transfer the technology to healthcare.gov. So, and during those conversations, which Tina also participated in, we had very frank discussions about the history of contingency planning at the organization. So it's something I take very seriously. What we do know is that with the transfer of the technology to use healthcare.gov for enrollment and eligibility in the appeals process as it relates to the commercial population. It leaves a large number of functions that need to remain in the state. Plan management, so working with the carriers to ensure that quality standards are met for products that are available for sale in the state. Working with agents and brokers who are authorized to sell products in the state. It's a shared responsibility with the federal government, but the state still maintains a role. Working on outreach and education, so ensuring that people that live in the state have access to resources that can help them wade this decision-making process about something that may be foreign to them or a process that they've never participated in before, and ensuring that they have a trusted resource available that, to them to help wade to make that decision. We have a table that I'd be happy to provide to you that was reviewed during the committee meetings yesterday that clearly outlines the functions that were in place in 2014. And then compares where those functionalities go for 2015. I think it would help answer the question. From a fundamental perspective, though, the state will need to maintain these functions in order to maintain the marketplace here in the state. And there are inherent benefits to keeping those functionalities in the state, regardless of if it's as a freestanding organization or a program of the state. Primarily that the assessment fee that we charge to consumers here for purchasing insurance products in the state is a percentage point less than what the federal government charges for use of their website. So there are inherent benefits. Part, obviously, of the transition process as we get into planning for the 2016 plan year will be given decisions that will be made. How do we plan to make sure that those functions that the state needs to retain, ensuring that they're transferred appropriately and that there are contingency plans for all of those? So it's something I take very seriously.
Final question. Do you have numbers of enrolled members?
So, Co-Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, we do. So I can provide the exact numbers. They're my presentation that I gave yesterday that I don't have with me right now, but I can ballpark them for you if that's okay. So from a commercial perspective, commercial members that have come through Cover Oregon, we're over 101,000 members that have come through Cover Oregon seeking coverage. And the OHP number is about 290,000, I think.
Through Cover Oregon.
There's an additional 140 or so thousand that have enrolled through the fast track process. That's an OHA process. So when you sum them all up, it ends up being around 494,000 members that have gained coverage over 2014, either using Cover Oregon or the Oregon Health Authority fast track process.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just want to revisit a question that I had that didn't quite get answered.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet.
You wanted the other two timelines?
Yes. Well, talking about the Medicaid enrollment, and you talked about eligibility determination. Once that has been made, that they're instantly covered. How long does Medicaid eligibility take?
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Thatcher, if a consumer comes in through healthcare.gov and gets a real-time eligibility determination, at maximum it will take the federal marketplace 7 days to send us that determination, because we'll get that file at least once a week.
But
so
they will know at the end of their, they will know when they're done filling out their application that they're eligible.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, the consumer on the Medicaid side, when they go to healthcare.gov, will know when they finish their application and submit whether they're eligible or not. The piece that Sarah is referring to is how long it takes to come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the enrollment process. Alternatively, if a consumer comes through the OHA front door, they'll complete their application, they'll hit submit. Frankly, it depends on how much work is in the process for actual eligibility determination. I'm not sure off the top of my head what the current processing time is, except that they're in lifetime. So my estimate is 3 or 4 days it takes to get a notice that says you've been determined eligible, and then we transmit that file on a daily basis, and it goes through the normal enrollment process. So instead of knowing live time when you hit submit on the button that you do if you're determined eligible from the federal side, it takes 3 or 4 days for us to send you a notice that says we've determined you to be eligible or no, in fact, you're not eligible, and we need you to go to healthcare.gov to apply for health coverage.
Real quick, just so 3 or 4 business days, right? So
yes.
Right. So it could be Wednesday, and then they still might not know Monday. Okay.
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Thatcher. Yes, you know, in the last open enrollment period, we ran 7x24. I don't think that the Oregon Health Authority has intention of running 7-day-a-week shifts. So 3 or 4 business days is the answer.
Madam Chair, before we end, I just wanted to thank you for your testimony, but I wanted to give some recognition to our committee administrator and our LFO staff that are here too, but particularly to the committee administrator because of this is the third committee she's been with me today, so this is about her 7th hour of committee hearings today. So it's not just this committee, so I just wanted to put that on.
You're blushing.
We greatly appreciate the work that our committee administrator serves for us, getting us prepared. So thank you so much. I would just have to say as we're ending that, you know, it seems like we've got a path to go, a lot of mitigation that needs to happen. I'm really hopeful by the August 15th date that we're at a place where we can have enrollment happen in a smooth process. It's taken us a long time to get there, and we're very hopeful. It seems like we've got a good team in place to do that. You know, we don't want to have more of those setbacks, but I think even more importantly, we want to have good transparency so that there can be accountability for all the people involved. So thanks for the time today. And with that, I'm going to close the committee on joint audits and information management technology. Thank you. Information management technology. Thank you. On joint audits and